Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here. A little early start this morning, a half an hour earlier, because we're following the Hawks. And it is Monday morning. And so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We get that coming up. And the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski are coming up. We'll discuss the box office as well, as we do every single Monday morning. We'll catch up on the movies from last week, too. We were off because of the Oscars. And so we're going to get Jim and Eric's thoughts on the Academy Awards as well. So that's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We're going to be talking about celebrity crushes a little bit later. Who are yours? And we also have celebrities who've had crushes on other celebrities. So what they were when they were growing up. So we'll do some celebrity crush talk. We're also going to talk about some of the greatest TV characters of all time. And that's all right here on 720 WGN. To get a hold of us, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/Nick D Show. And that's all coming up. Okay, let's say hello to let me have my producer introduce himself. It's Ben is not in this morning.
Hey, this is Tom Hush.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing well, Nick. Good. How are you doing, man?
All right. We see each other, you know, frequently.
Yeah, passing in the hallways.
First time we've ever worked together.
Yeah, very exciting.
Very cool, man. Well, cool. I also, a little bit later on, I want to talk about your podcast that you...
oh, man. Appreciate it. Yeah, let's talk.
Because I know you're a movie guy. And I want to get.
Well, I'd love to bow at the Temple of Cinema with you. I'd really appreciate it.
Well, it's cool. Well, right away you endeared yourself to me with your sweatshirt.
Oh yeah, I knew I was working with you, so I had to wear my Kill Bill sweatshirt.
Yeah, it's awesome. That's it's very, very cool, man. So that's Tom. He's producing this morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's go into the newsroom, and it's Vic Vaughn. Hiya, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, pal?
Doing well.
Good. How was your weekend?
Yeah, pretty good. Spent a lot of the time inside, but we did get out a little bit yesterday. Jeannie and I did, but it was a nice weekend.
Very, very cool. That's boy, this weather is ridiculous. Don't you think this is just ridiculous?
Hopefully the last cold weekend. I mean, what do you guys think? I hope it is.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I don't even know what to say anymore. So,
got to warm up eventually.
It has to. Yes. You know, it's funny. I was watching the hockey game at home before I came in. They had a commercial for a spring auto sale. And they had like flowers blooming on TV. Right. And I'm like, you know, I'm watching this right now. It's spring auto sale right now. It's 8 degrees outside.
Not in San Jose, though.
No. Ridiculous. So anyway, boy, the Hawks are giving me a hard time.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Not a good weekend.
No, it's not. And it was a rough weekend for them. And that, you know what? It's getting close to saying that this could be the end of the season, because they've
that hurt dropping what, two out of the three on the road trip.
Yeah, they needed those too, man. They should have won against the Kings. I mean, come on. I know the Sharks are a tough team. Sharks are a great team, but man, you should have won against the Kings.
Yeah, you know, Troy was saying had they played the way they did tonight against the Kings, they would have won that one.
Yeah,
likely.
Yeah, I'll tell you what though. You know, that game, the game last night that we just ended now. Or ended about a while ago, was really exciting to watch, man. I mean, it was a fast-paced hockey game. It was exciting.
Yeah, I mean, 5-2, you think a blowout, but no, it was close. It was into close. The third before.
Into the third, yeah, into the third. It started to, it blew apart in the third period, yeah. But those first two periods were strong, especially yeah. the second period. That second period was really exciting.
Yeah.
And the Sharks are a fast team, man. They get down that ice quick.
They're good.
Yeah. So, anyway, we've got the Blackhawks Express to play back. We'll do that after my dad tells a joke, which is coming up on a Monday morning. Did anybody watch Saturday Night Live? Tom, did you watch Saturday Night
Live? Yeah, I watched a bit of the clips. I'm one of those guys that goes back and I'll sift through the YouTube. Yeah. But I love the opening monologue. John Mulaney, what a talent.
Listen, they did this thing. I don't know if you saw the clip, but they did this thing, and Mulaney wrote it, called the Bodega Bathroom. Have you seen that?
Yeah, it was spectacular.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And Mulaney wrote that. It was kind of a pseudo kind of sequel to the Lobster thing that they did, that Mulaney mm-hmm. also wrote. Now, the Lobster thing, where Pete Davidson plays a guy who orders a lobster in a diner, and then they do like a Les Mis, like a musical number. It was brilliant. It was brilliant. That got axed. Mulaney wrote that years ago when he was a writer at on SNL, when he was actually hired, you know, when he was working for SNL. He wrote that sketch, and it got cut after Dress. Like, they were like, no, that doesn't work. And so he brought it back when he came back and hosted the first time. And then they did that Bodega Bathroom thing, man. I was on the floor. I was on the floor laughing. So funny. But yeah, it was a strong episode. No question about it. It was a really, really funny episode all the way through. But yeah. And I got to say, I watched Svengoolie on Saturday night, because that's how I party on Saturdays. I watch Svengoolie and then Saturday Night Live. That's how I party. So Svengoolie showed The Black Cat over the weekend, and this is a really strange, kind of a lovely black and white. It was 1940. It was made, not based on the Edgar Allan Poe. It's a completely separate thing, and it's got like Broderick Crawford, Basil Rathbone, Alan Ladd. So, you know, some classic actors. But my favorite part of the whole movie, and I guess I never caught it before. I've seen this movie a bunch of times. I guess I never caught it before. But at one point, Broderick Crawford, because there's somebody is like, there's a bunch of mystery throughout the movie. It's like a house full of people and mysterious murders and weird things are happening and who's responsible. It's that kind of thing. Like, you know, you're
a little
you're
Scooby-Doo there.
Yeah, exactly. Your mystery in a house, in a creepy house filled with a lot of people who might be suspects. It's that kind of thing. But at one point, Broderick Crawford, who's kind of the lead in the movie, but he's really goofy. It's a really goofy performance. I don't know. I guess I didn't remember how goofy Broderick Crawford was in the movie, but he really is. So at one point they're trying to figure out, you know, like what the current mystery that they're trying to figure out. And Broderick Crawford and Basil Rathbone are in the scene together. And Basil Rathbone says, I can't remember the exact line, I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like, "I think this is what happened." And then Broderick Crawford says to Basil Rathbone, or to the people in the room about Basil Rathbone, he says, "Hey, he thinks he's Sherlock Holmes." And Basil Rathbone is Sherlock Holmes. That was the thing. He played Sherlock Holmes. And I never caught that before, and I busted out laughing. I was like, wait a minute, did he just like do like a meta joke in 1940? Did he just like throw in break the fourth wall kind of a joke? And what it was really funny, because like as soon as he says it, he's like, he thinks he's Sherlock Holmes. I'm like, that's hilarious. So I posted that on my Facebook page, and when they went to the next break, Rich was talking about it, and then he said, here's my favorite line from the movie, and he said that line. He said, he thinks he's Sherlock Holmes, and he said that Basil Rathbone had just signed the contract to play Sherlock Holmes while they were making The Black Cat. So that was an inside joke on the part of Broderick Crawford, you know, because he did just sign the contract to become Sherlock Holmes. So Broderick Crawford, he thinks he's Sherlock Holmes, cracked me up. And that's a weird movie. Black Cat's a weird movie. Weird movie.
Weird is good.
Yeah, no, it is. And anytime, you know, I mean, I could watch Rich Coase do anything, man. I mean, Svengoolie is just, you know, he's a good friend of the show, and he's a hell of a nice guy, and his show rules. It just has, you know, this is his 40th year doing Svengoolie.
Wow.
40th year. Vic, can you believe that? 40 years Rich Coase has been doing Svengoolie.
That's incredible.
Isn't that nuts? He started, obviously he started in 1979, as son of Svengoolie. So he was son of Svengoolie for years, and then Jerry D. Bishop, who was the original Svengoolie in the 60s and early 70s, gave Rich permission to just say that he's Svengoolie. He doesn't have to say son of Svengoolie anymore. So he got actual permission from Jerry G. Bishop, the original Svengoolie, to become Svengoolie and drop the son. And because he was good friends with Jerry G. Bishop. Jerry G. Bishop, that's how he got into it all, was because he used to write jokes for Jerry G. Bishop. And they became really close friends. And so, you know, as the years went by and they wanted to revive the character as son of Svengoolie, you know, he went to Jerry G. Bishop and he's like, could I do this? Is it okay if I do this and bring it back? And Jerry G. Bishop was like, I can't imagine anybody else doing the character but you. And he does it differently than what Jerry G. Bishop did. Jerry G. Bishop was, you know, his Svengoolie was, he was basically a hippie. He wore tie-dye and he had really long hair and he's like, hey, man. And so what Sven is doing, or what Rich is doing, is different.
And then I still remember seeing Rich without the, you know, the without makeup and the costume. I had no idea that that was Svengoolie.
Yeah. Well, he just filled in, you know, like in October, just this past October. He was on before me. He filled in. Him and Jim.
That was the night, I think, that I'm talking about, when I saw him out here in the studio. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy. He really is. Okay. All right. We got a break here. That's the show that's coming up this morning. And the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Eric and Jim are coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are also going to talk about celebrity crushes. What were your big celebrity crushes and the crushes that celebrities had on other celebrities when they were growing up? So we'll get into that. And we're also going to talk about really memorable TV characters as well. Phone lines are always open for text and call and talking. It's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. It's Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Every week, Eric Childress and Jim Leskowski join me to review the new movies. We were not on last week. I took the morning off after the Oscars, so we're going to catch up on stuff from last week and then review the new stuff from this week. There's not a lot, though, but let's welcome Eric Childress to the show. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
And let's welcome Jim Leskowski. Welcome back, Jim.
Hello there. Nice to be back.
All right. So, Eric, before we get into this, I saw that you and Colin posted that you did 6 hours worth of podcasting about the year, about the movie year of 1989.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks to our friend Mr. Leskowski here. This is our annual podcast where we were basically a 30-year retrospective of an entire year in film. So today, you know, like a half hour, you know, June when we took a break, we realized we were 3 hours in. Wow. And then we did another 3 hours.
Wow. I'm assuming you covered everything.
Yeah, that's epic.
Yeah.
We covered just about. I mean, we skipped around, you know, some non-essential titles, but we went through from January to December.
Wow. Well, that should be fun to listen to. I'm trying to remember what my favorite movie of 89 was. Do the Right Thing, I think, was my favorite movie of 89.
That, I think we talked about that, Jim, right? Do the Right Thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And Casualties of War. Did you guys talk about Casualties of War?
We did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, well, I'll have to give that a listen because those are some great movies, 1989. Okay. So we were off last week for the Academy Awards. First, Eric, what did you think of the awards?
I liked it. I mean, generally, the exception of some of the results, obviously, there's an odd smoothness to them. I mean, no host. I didn't really miss a host. I thought, you know, the stars, when they were doing their bits and whatnot, came up pretty well.
Yeah.
And, you know, not having, you know, 18,000 tributes during the show, I thought was also most welcome not to have. Though it's still, you know, someone needs to hire someone for the In Memoriam segment that knows what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, I know. There were massive omissions.
Yeah.
I mean, just like ridiculous. And every year they miss at least 2-3 people, but this year was nuts.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it came in a half an hour shorter than last year.
I didn't see that, but that felt about right.
Yeah, it came in a half an hour shorter than last year, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's no 20-minute opening monologue.
Right.
You know, I mean, there was no host to do 50, because they do at least 15, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
At the top of the show. Now, that cut that out completely. I could have done without, you know, Queen and Adam Lambert, but...
Well, yeah, as I texted you during the show, like... Yeah. For 40-some years, I would have been happy to see Queen, you know, open the Oscars.
Yeah.
Not this year.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just mad at Brian May and Roger Taylor at this point. So I'm just,
I am too.
So I'm very angry with those guys. So, Jim, what did you think?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty much with you guys in general about the show. I was worried initially with the Queen opening because I just, why try Adam Lambert?
Yeah.
I just... You know, that just left me a little concerned at the start there, but the pacing was pretty good for a show that tends to lag and move at a slog sometimes. So I think that having no host was a plus in this regard. I mean, I know I messaged you a couple of times when Bohemian Rhapsody was winning awards for sound, for editing and sound effects.
Yeah.
Sound design and all that stuff, and that was driving me bonkers. Yeah, because it didn't deserve it.
No, of course not. No, it didn't. It absolutely didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that, like, it beat out First Man, you know, I mean, what are we talking about here? Well, what about the actual results of the awards? Everybody, there's a huge backlash against Green Book,
mm-hmm.
Which is a movie I still like. I don't care. I think it's a good movie, and I think that those two performances are so great, and the chemistry between those two guys is really great, but people seem very angry, especially Spike Lee. So it's like,
well, yeah, as we again, we something we this has been talked about many times, and we even brought up on the podcast, you know, today, that, you know, the irony that,
yeah.
as Spike said, whenever someone's driving someone, I lose.
Yeah,
and
this
that
time,
sums
this
it up
time,
perfectly.
This time, it was a white guy driving a black guy.
Right. We eliminated the woman from the proceedings, and now it's two men.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, I think the roller coaster ride that was the awards where, you know, like, I predicted Roma. I think there were a lot of people that were still clinging to that. And then when we saw Black Panther winning stuff, we're like, well, maybe that could happen at the end of the night.
Yeah.
And then Bohemian Rhapsody's winning, like, oh, no.
Yeah.
But I think even by the end, I didn't even consider Green Book was going to pull it out.
I didn't think so either. I really didn't. Really thought Roma was going to win both. I thought Roma was going to win foreign film and picture because it deserves it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I was great to see Caron win again. And what was the stat now? The last like six Oscars, five times a Mexican director has won, correct?
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Caron won twice, Inarritu won twice, and Del Toro.
Right. That's crazy.
Yeah, the three amigos.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Won five of the six Oscars.
And I don't have a problem with that at all. I think that's great. So.
No, they're all great.
So, Jim, what did you think of some of the results, the awards themselves?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised at Olivia Colman winning for the favorite. I don't think anybody predicted that. And her speech was a delight, as expected. She is fantastic, and I'm so happy for her.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I thought Glenn Close was a lock. I thought she was. I would have bet everything on Glenn Close being one of the for sure winners of that night.
Yeah.
So, I'm not upset that Olivia Colman won, because I think she's great in the movie. And again, as you said, her speech was fantastic. I mean, I wasn't surprised by really anything else in the major categories. Everything else was pretty much expected. I was really happy to see Spike win an Oscar, and I love that he just jumped into Samuel L. Jackson's arms and wrapped his legs around him. I just thought that was just so cool that Samuel Jackson was up there to present that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there's, I mean, that whole moment, I mean, I pointed out to my mom that, you know, the Oscars, as much as they say, like, the envelopes are sealed, we don't even know. Like, they know. So, like, they know when they're getting certain people to present the awards.
Yeah.
They know who's in that envelope.
Yeah.
But the juxtaposition of Samuel Jackson having to read Green Book for original screenplay then Black Klansman.
Right.
Was kind of perfect.
Yeah, it was. I will say this, that I was surprised that Green Book got screenplay. That was a surprise to me. Anyway, well, overall, not a bad show.
Mm-hmm.
It was entertaining. You know, I was fine with some of the winners, and you know, and I thought the idea. I think we all agree on this that it was kind of. I think they should go hostless from now on. I mean, you know, that's the way to go, man. Cutting a half an hour out of the show. It's still smooth. You still have people coming out and doing bits. You still have got, you know, a great chunk of celebrity. So you're not missing that element of it. So, yeah. I mean, I overall, you know, it was a very weird leading up to the show, you know, because of all the weirdness that was happening with the Oscars. Like, first of all, the Kevin Hart thing and, you know, and then he drops out. And then they're wondering who they're going to get to host. They're trying to get, you know, like Ellen DeGeneres was trying to get to... Kevin Hart, she actually called the Academy and said that they should get him to come back on. She wanted him to host. That went on for a while, and then there was no host. Mm-hmm. And then the idiots at the Academy decided that they wanted to not broadcast four of the Academy Award nominations, including Best Cinematography
and editing.
And
right?
Editing. I mean, the other two. I mean, think every you know obviously, and then they did a reversal on that.
Yeah,
and then as it got closer and closer, finally they put out the press release that they're going without a host. So it was a bumpy ride, you know what I mean, to get to the that award show. So
yeah, it was literally the worst produced Oscar show. I mean, all the preparation going up to it. I mean, the show itself came off mostly without a hitch.
Yeah,
but all the decisions leading up to it was like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
every time a story would come out, and I'm surprised. I mean, it was amazing to me that they backtracked on everything after the public outrage over it. And now, don't forget, they were going to have most popular film as a category at one point.
That's right. Oh my God. Well, just leave things be. That's all I'm saying. So, I guess the ratings were up from last year.
Minorly.
The ratings were up from last year, and it was really funny because the night after the Oscars, I watched Kimmel, and he was like, I feel really bad about that. Because he hosted 2 years in a row, too, Kimmel, and he does a great job, I think. And of course, he's always going to be down in history as the host of the night where they said La La Land was Best Picture, and it was.
That's right.
So, all right, well, the Oscars are done, and we were off last week, so we got a couple of movies from last weekend to talk about that we're going to catch up on. And then basically only one movie, because none of us saw Tyler Perry's A Madea Family Funeral.
Yeah, as long as he keeps not screening the movies, I'm not going to see him.
Yeah.
That's my policy.
All right. Yeah. All right, guys, hang on, okay? Hang on a second. All right, Eric Childress is with us. Jim Liskowski is with us. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we got more coming up. We're going to play some catch-up from last week since we weren't on, and then we'll review the new movie that came out this week. All right, that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN.
Silent movie evening. There's a light in the skies over
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories of beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 o'clock every weekday morning. I'm on 1 to 5. I'm your overnight dude. We're going to be talking about celebrity crushes, so think about yours. And and some of the greatest TV characters of all time. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning and it's a jokey time. And it is Monday morning, which means we are doing the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Jim Laskowski join me every Monday to talk about the new movies. And then Eric, I'll stick around and we'll talk box office as well. So let's welcome back. Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello there.
All right. Let's start with we had a couple of movies that came out last week. And so, Jim, why don't you start us off with How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World?
All right. Yeah, so this is the third film in the delightful How to Train Your Dragon series. This one picks up about 1 year after the rather action-packed, harrowing events of the second film. We see that the humans here are living peacefully in the Viking town of Burk, and they all have become completely integrated, I would say, with their dragon friends. Of course, we have Hiccup here, voiced by Jay Baruchel, who's now a young man and has risen to the ranks of chief alongside his trusty alpha dragon, Toothless. It essentially remains his companion and protector. Hiccup's plan is essentially to move the colony, potentially, to a place known as the Hidden World, which is a mythical dragon paradise. But at the same time, he would also be content to remain in familiar surroundings. But, of course, there's going to be conflict, and it's in the form of this faction of warlords who don't want to conquer the world and are bent on enslaving all dragons to fight, in an army, more or less, instead of allowing them to be friendly companions, including the ones, all the dragons that live in Burk. So these warlords enlist Master Dragon Hunter Grimmel, voiced by the great F. Murray Abraham, to capture Toothless. He unleashes a White Knight Fury female dragon to distract Toothless away from Hiccup in hopes of whisking him away. But, of course, Toothless is cozying up to the first female of his species that he's ever encountered before. Simultaneously, Hiccup is also trying to figure out his relationship with Astrid, voiced once again by America Ferreira. And, there's a little bit of pressure, too, from the community that expects them to eventually wed and live happily ever after, so to speak. But what we slowly begin to experience here is just our main characters that we've all grown to love growing up and learning how to make adult decisions for the first time, including where they would ultimately like to be in the end, and, of course, making sure the villain doesn't achieve his goal by taking control of the dragon community. So that's pretty much the gist of the plot here. I mean, when the first film came out, I was hugely surprised and delighted because, the series comes to us from DreamWorks Animation, which was a studio that, kind of more or less copycat Pixar with movies like Ants and Shark Tale, kind of, wanting to ride the coattails of A Bug's Life or something like Finding Nemo. But they also had the huge hit of Shrek and many copious sequels to follow that I wasn't as high up on as, what we've come to expect from Pixar Animation, of course. And I've never been, the hugest fan of the fantasy film genre in general, but, the original, like so many, I was just instantly won over by the animation. And, of course, what can you say about a memorable character like Toothless, who, for anyone who's owned a pet, I think can find some connection to in some way or another. And throughout this series, the world's just become even more and more realized and jaw-droppingly beautiful. I found myself really emotionally invested in the first two films, particularly with a surprising loss in the second film. And in the third one here, we flash back to a lovely moment involving Hiccup and his dad, as his dad tells him that, with true love comes loss. That's kind of part of the deal here. So, that's sort of the gist of the themes here. And, once again, this is a really insightful film for the whole family that is about growing up and letting go and allowing those that you're closest to experience happiness and their potential in their own way. And as you would expect, the animation here is just breathtaking and lively throughout, full of really great depth and color. Just the environment here is astonishing. I think the when you get to the hidden world, this haven of different kinds of dragons, it really showcases the talent of all these animators, because there's a whole ton of different types of dragons here that you get to see. And that's a real joy. I mean, I just kind of watch this as it goes on and kind of go, man, this is really enveloping. And for, a genre that I'm not usually attached to in any way. I think the voice acting is great. Jay Baruchel does what he usually does and does it well. F. Murray Abraham does a solid villain. And, of course, what can you say about the incredible score? It continues to be great. And the introduction of another dragon here for Toothless is really cute and really charming. You kind of know where the film ultimately ends up, but because you care about these characters and their journey together, you will get swept up all over again with the same sort of spirit and joy of the previous two films. And as most fans expect, this is just a marvel, especially if you see it in IMAX, which I did, and I was very happy to. The series remains one of the most consistent animated trilogies of all time. So if you're a fan of the first two, I think you will be every bit as delighted by this conclusion to the saga here that I was. So huge recommendation.
Yeah, I still haven't caught up on it yet, but I love the first two movies. Two movies. And Eric, you haven't caught up on it yet either, have you?
No, not yet, but I can't wait.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it either. All the reviews have been good, and yeah. Jim, I'm glad to hear that you liked it. So, all right.
Absolutely.
All right, also from last week, Eric, tell us about Fighting With My Family.
Yeah, I talked briefly about this from Sundance this year, where they had the worst-kept surprise screening in all of Sundance. But this is the true story of a family in England that's represented by, in the movie, Florence Pugh. Family is basically a wrestling family. They put on wrestling shows. It was a self-contained show, and it was very popular over there. As a matter of fact, a documentary was made about them. That's a reference in the movie, although we don't actually see them. It's not really part of the story. But Florence Pugh plays the daughter of the wrestling family, and as tapes of them circulate, her and her brother, played by Jack Lowden, are given a shot by the WWE to join their recruitment program, the show called WWE Next. And they're given a shot to audition for the WWE. Alas, she gets chosen. The brother does not. So he has to go back home, and she goes through a pretty rigorous training exercise. Vince Vaughn plays the guy in charge of not just the auditions, but the actual the wrestling show. And it's this girl's journey, who eventually would become known as Paige. She was the youngest WWE diva, or the WWE diva champion in all of WWE. And this is it's a really kind of inspiring story. It's a story that in many respects we've seen played out.
Okay, Eric, hang on, hang on a second. We're going to take a break.
All right.
I want to make sure that we get everybody in. We get our full reviews in. Hang on, guys. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric Childress, Jim Liskowski are here. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Eric will tell us more about Fighting With My Family, and then I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. And that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. It's a backcourt battle as the Bulls look to polish off the Pacers in Indy. Bulls Pacers Tuesday at 6 on WGN TV Sports.
Life, news, thought, opinion, learning.
Let's learn more together on 720 WGN.
Invest your tax refund in a kitchen renovation that will pay dividends for years to come. Hi, I'm Tom Janke of the Edge Kitchen and Bath Showrooms with Lindsay of House Smarts Radio.
Tom, the kitchen is where people spend so much of their time.
I know, so make it incredible. Let our top designers show you our gorgeous kitchen cabinets, countertops, and flooring. We can meet any design need and budget.
And Tom, you have the best professional designers. They listen to your needs and bring your dream kitchen to life on a giant screen.
And it's all free of charge. Book a free consultation today.
Plus, you have hundreds of gorgeous granite and quartz countertops.
And we'll install them in 10 days or less with complete customer satisfaction.
The Edge Kitchen and Bath Showroom and Builder Supply Outlet on Cermak Road at 25th Avenue in Broadview. Or The Edge on 151st Street in Orland Park.
And online at edgekitchenandbath.com.
High-end look without the high-end price.
The Edge
Kitchen and Bath Showroom.
From Builder Supply Outlet.
You're late for work and still have to drop off the kids at school. You jump in your car, hit the garage door remote, and nothing happens. Now what?
Green Tea Services, service to a
green tea.
Hi, it's Tonya Khoury for my family business, Green Tea Services. Right now, we have a garage door maintenance special. Our trained technicians come out and adjust the springs, check the cables, inspect the rollers, tighten hinges, and give your door and opener a complete lubrication. All for just $47.
Service to a
green tea.
This time of year, garage doors tend to fail. Don't get stuck in or out of your garage. Call for our $47 garage door maintenance special. Call Green Tea now for details. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
Green Tea Services. Service to a
green
tea. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
800-5-GREEN-TEA. Or greenteaservices.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, as we are every weekday morning. I'm here 1 to 5 a.m. It's Monday morning, and we're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because that's what we do on Monday morning. We're going to talk about celebrity crushes and classic TV characters. All that and more on this Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Eric Childress, Jim Liskowski join me every Monday morning to talk about the new movies. And Jim and Eric, Eric hangs out to talk about box office, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Before the break, Eric was telling us about Fighting With My Family. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's pick it up from where we left off, Fighting With My Family.
Okay, so as I was saying, this is, you know, kind of follows a very similar path to a number of underdog stories that we've seen in the past. This one, you know, obviously happens to be a true story. Wrestling has been one of those things that I've kind of woven in and out of throughout my life. Obviously, the Hulk Hogan years were a big part of my childhood, and then I left for a while, then I came back for a little while, and I left again and not really on that train so much. So I kind of miss the introduction of Paige, the real life Paige, into this world. But this movie is produced by Dwayne Johnson, who has a pretty significant two-scene cameo in the film. You know, this is a story that you could tell is, you know, kind of really, you know, really close to him, particularly given one of the moments in the movie that actually did occur in real life. And Florence Pugh, who plays Paige, is an actress that I am just in the opinion that I want to see in everything at this point. People, if you might not have seen a movie a few years ago called Lady Macbeth that I would highly recommend put on their radar. She was also in the AMC adaptation of The Little Drummer Girl that I watched all 6 hours of primarily because of her. And I think she's you know, really terrific here as well. I think, you know, many of the performances are really good. Vince Vaughn is really good as the trainer host of producer of the show. Nick Frost, Lena Headey, who play the parents of the family, are also good. I like that, you know, even though the movie in some ways is kind of a commercial for the WWE, I do like that they actually kind of admit that the diva portion of their wrestling is not exactly fully on the up and up, because basically it's just about a looks contest and is all about having models and cheerleaders and stuff like that. Not people, basically people who are not real wrestlers, as Paige was, be a part of this thing. And she was a real wrestler, and the juxtaposition of those storylines, I thought, at least there's a little bit of self-criticism there that I think is pretty worthy. But this is a movie that, you know, just ultimately just kind of won me over. Not just, you know, because of Pew, but Stephen Merchant, who wrote and directed the movie, I think does a really nice job. And, overselling this journey, not just constantly, you know, making it a commercial for the WWE. He feels really invested in her story. And even though, you know, it's kind of sacrilege to say that wrestling's fake, because obviously it's, incredibly dangerous. As you know, anyone who knows about Paige's history can attest. But even though it is rigged, there is a real sense of accomplishment by the end of this movie, and you really do root for this character. So yeah, I'm recommending Fighting With My Family.
I loved this movie. I loved it. It's my favorite film of the year so far. I know it's only March, but I adored this movie. Now, I'm a wrestling fan, and Paige is my favorite diva. I've always loved her, always. And I think it's awesome that they made this movie. And I don't know why I find it odd that Stephen Merchant is the writer and director of this movie. I just find that a little strange. And he's really funny in it, too, because he's also in the movie.
Well, you know that him and The Rock were in The Tooth Fairy together.
That's right. Merchant was on Graham Norton this past weekend, and they talked about the Tooth Fairy, and that was the connection that they had. Mm-hmm. But I just thought this movie was great. It's an inspiring story. It's not it's the whole underdog thing, but I just loved the family. I love the way that the family is portrayed. Nick Frost is fantastic in this movie. Lena Headey is great. The relationship between Jack Loudon and Florence Pugh, and I think Jack Loudon is fantastic in this movie, is really the emotional core of the film. And it really works. I mean, it really sucked me in. I was really emotionally invested in this movie, which I didn't think I would be. But I found this movie to be really lovely and really moving and not at all what I expected. I mean, it's this really sort of lovely little British comedy that just happens to take place in the world of WWE. And I really, the chemistry between the family is so great. I love all the characters that they train in their little wrestling alliance. The blind kid was one of my favorite things in the movie. I was just hook, line, and sinker with this thing. I really was, and I just thought everybody was great in it. I thought The Rock, his two scenes were fantastic, and this is the best performance Vince Vaughn has given in years. He's terrific in this movie. In a weird, when you think Vince Vaughn as like a, a pro wrestling WWE trainer / coach, you go, what? That's like weird casting, but he's completely authentic in it. I bought everything he said. He's also really funny in it. I mean, there's dialogue in this movie that just totally had me cracking up. Like when he was teaching all the recruits how to cut promos.
Yeah,
it was hilarious. And when he first meets the group, and they're all standing in the ring together, and they're telling him their names, and he's just ripping them apart. All that stuff was just great. And again, like you said, Florence Pugh is she's great. She's really, really great, and she's good in the ring, man. She learned her stuff for this movie. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
I also find it hilarious, and I don't know if Eric, I'll just find it hilarious that Nick Frost plays the father of a guy who looks exactly like Simon Pegg. I thought that was...
I didn't put that together.
He's a dead ringer for Simon Pegg. And I was like, I think that's hilarious that Nick Frost is playing that part. But yeah, and if you're a wrestling fan, there are a few cameos, a few surprise cameos late in the movie that are kind of fun. I think it is kind of strange that they had somebody play AJ Lee. They had somebody play AJ Lee, but they did use the real audio, like the real call from Raw that night when she won the belt.
That's interesting.
But I guess because they had an actor playing Paige, you know, they had an actress playing Paige. They should have an actress playing AJ Lee. But anyway, I was entertained from front to back to this movie, and I found it genuinely touching. And I honest to God didn't think I was going to be emotionally involved in this movie at all, and I really was. And I just think it's a lovely movie, and I didn't expect to say, "Hey, Fighting with My Family is a lovely movie," but it really is. And I just think it's an incredibly likable film, and you don't have to be a wrestling fan to enjoy it. And there's like the training sequences, and again, Eric, you brought up the whole, like, you know, admitting that a lot of the girls who are in the Divas division are hired because of their bodies, and because of how they look. But then that goes beyond anything, because the relationship that she eventually has with those three women is lovely. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't expect it to go there.
Right.
And there's a great scene late in the movie where they're training and they're trying to, you know, like one girl is having a really hard time. You know, like at one point they have to flip the giant, you know, those giant truck tires over and over again.
Yes.
And then the way they work with each other and encourage each other, I found that beautiful. I don't know.
It's funny, during one of the periods where I was watching wrestling, semi-regularly, at one point they had like this big, like, Divas search thing. It's the one that Christy Hemme eventually won. And I remember when that happened, I like recognized like three or four of the women that were in the thing. I'm like, that's an actress. Like, I've seen her in stuff before. She's not exactly some fresh face, you know. So she's a former model or a former, you know, B movie actress or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it is. I mean, obviously, it is a big. You know, there's obviously it's a big commercial for the WWE. But I don't think. I mean, we knew that going in.
Mm-hmm.
The only weird thing, I will say this. The only weird thing is how the final match is portrayed, because. You know, there's a sense of, ooh, is she going to win? You know what I mean? There's like, it's shown as if it were like a real match that was not predetermined.
Right.
You know, and it's shot in a very suspenseful way. You know what I mean? Like, there's a count out. It's one, two, and everybody freaks out. But when in fact, everybody knew going in, AJ Lee, Paige, everybody knew what the outcome is, because that's what wrestling is. You know what. But it was weird that Stephen Merchant played it like for suspense, like it was a real, like it was a real match. Well, you know, so.
But I think that's, you know, I mean, I think you can actually argue the point that it was real to her.
As a wrestling fan and as someone who knows that everything is predetermined.
Yeah.
Because I was so emotionally involved in it, I was moved by it. Obviously this big moment for her coming out in front of the audience, the big crowd like that and everything, that was beautifully handled as well. But I just thought it was terrific. I really did. So that's Fighting with My Family. Eric liked it, and I loved it. Okay, guys, hang on, all right?
Okay.
All right, we're going to get to that. Those were last week's movies. We've only got one movie to review for this week, and we're going to come back and review Greta right after this on 720 WGN. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and how's it going? We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about celebrity crushes, your celebrity crushes, your when you were a kid or now, or also celebrities who had celebrity crushes. I got a whole story about that, which is kind of fun. So that's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to talk or text with us. 312-981-7200. All right. Eric Childress, Jim Leskowski with me this morning to talk about the new movie. There's only one to talk about this week. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right, Jim, tell us about Greta.
Great. Well, this comes to us from an excellent director by the name of Neil Jordan, who I've been a fan of going all the way back to The Company of Wolves. His latest film introduces us to a young woman named Frances, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, who is still in mourning from the loss of her mother when she arrives in Manhattan to become roommates with her friend Erica, played by Micah Monroe. They live a peaceful existence, more or less, in a sprawling Tribeca loft financed by Erica's father, with Francis's widowed father mostly trying to stay hard at work and stay in touch with his daughter. The film essentially wastes no time in the setup when Francis finds a handbag seemingly left by accident on a subway seat. And, of course, being the honest woman that she is, Frances bikes all across the city to return the handbag to its rightful owner, who happens to live in this sort of dark Brooklyn abode at the end of a long alley. The woman who answers the doorbell is the title character, Greta, played by the great Isabelle Huppert, who, is very happy that Frances has returned her handbag, and she invites her in for conversation and tea. And it starts out, kind of as this harmless connection, more or less, and slowly becomes increasingly questionable. Erica seems to think that Frances is only seeking out a surrogate mother figure since she's still in mourning, and slowly but surely, Greta herself becomes instantly attached and codependent and starts stalking Frances outside the restaurant where she works, begins texting and calling constantly, and proclaiming that Frances does need a mother figure in her life, and Greta's very tired of people leaving her and leaving her life. So, of course, the cops become involved, but there isn't a whole lot they can do, and a restraining order may become necessary at one point. And, well, if you've seen a number of thrillers from the 90s, you can probably guess that things go from bad to worse as the film progresses here. So I'll start out by saying that Neil Jordan is a more than capable director that does a fine job here. It's like a short 90-minute thriller that, like I mentioned, wastes no time and contains another really great turn from Isabelle Huppert, who is always a marvel to watch in just about anything. And Chloe Grace Moretz is good, too. She grounds the film, making her anxiety and concern very believable. And in general, I'm kind of a fan of creepy thrillers about codependence, particularly something like Single White Female or The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. I always enjoy those types of films, which, is also kind of the reason why I found Greta to be a little unremarkable in the screenplay department. I just feel like I've seen this scenario many times before, and it plays out very predictably, I think. Like I said, Neil Jordan kind of wants to play the audience like a piano, and at the same time, I found that the notes very similar. Stephen Ray shows up late in the film and is kind of given very little to do.
Well, that's because legally he has to be in every Neil Jordan movie.
That's right.
That's a law.
Sure.
Yeah, so, even if he's not awake.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I don't have a problem with. I'm glad to see him, of course. By the time we reached the third act here, I was kind of able to predict how things would resolve. And, I think the trailer kind of gave away a couple of the better moments, including the discovery of Greta's scheme and a confrontation at a restaurant that was, as it plays out, is actually very effective. But I also think tonally it could have gone a little crazier or campier for me to be top to bottom entertaining, or at least stood out from the pack. I kind of wish it was just more psychologically complex than something that we haven't seen before. It's serviceable. It's not necessarily boring. And there's one moment that does subvert expectations in an interesting way that I won't give away. But, outside of a few moments here and there, I was disappointed. I kind of shrugged this one off a little bit. If you're a fan of Huppert here, she's good. She's very, very good. And I do think Jordan is a great director, but I'm just not a fan of the script in general. So I'm not going to fully recommend this one. I was relatively disappointed and wouldn't put this in the upper tier of Neil Jordan films.
All right. Eric?
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same boat. I think this is a movie that kind of flirts the line between campy and psychological, and I think the movie needed to choose one of those lanes with a little more authority. I hadn't seen the trailer for the movie, so I didn't really know much about the movie going into it. And so, like, the reveal that I assume Jim's talking about in the trailer, in the movie felt pretty jarring, and like it felt like, even the way it's presented, it felt like it was like some big third act reveal, even though it's pretty much at the end of the first act. And even the circumstances surrounding that reveal and what, you know, Chloe Grace finds, and their phone numbers written on it, which seemed like of like, really, you just leave that kind of around, hanging around, but, you know, yeah. That's maybe reading a little too much into the movie. But, you know, but as the movie goes along, I will say Isabel Huppert is really terrific in the movie. You know, I think she's having fun with the movie, but the movie doesn't seem to be having a lot of fun itself, I don't think. The Micah Monroe roommate character, I think, is pretty one-dimensional. I didn't like the way that character plays out. Watching Neil Jordan attempt to go De Palma with this, which he does on a couple different occasions, just, I think, really kind of fall with a huge thud. There's a dream sequence in the middle of the movie that I think is just kind of like, ugh. And then there's a big, you know, plot point in the third act where, you know, he does basically the faceless, like, we're going to keep the identity of this person off screen, and as soon as that person picks up the handbag on the train, I'm like, I know who that is. Mm-hmm. And then it takes 10 minutes to reveal that. So that wasn't that big of a surprise. And then the third act is just, you know, when you expect it to hopefully go high camp at that point, because what else has it got to lose? It just doesn't quite go that way. There's a kitchen scene that I think, you know, lives up to that moment, but it dies out pretty quickly. And the way it kind of leaves the movie, you know, suggests that, you know, there's kind of a greater psychological thing that could have been explored here, but I just don't think it went down either road. So to me, the movie was, you know, never achieves a certain level of fun, and never achieves, you know, the kind of moving, you know, like Jim said, a kind of 90s thriller, psycho thriller along these lines that Neil Jordan would try to subvert in some way. And I don't think he succeeds on either level. So it was a disappointment for me, too.
I really liked it. I really liked it. And I thought Neil Jordan directed it beautifully. And Isabel Huppert, as we all agree, she's great in this movie.
Yeah.
And Chloe Grace Moretz is the perfect casting for this film. I do think it's an absolute throwback to stuff like Single White Female and, you know, and those 90s movies. And I think it's a perfectly made kind of throwback to those type of movies, and I think it's effective. I was involved in it. I thought it was some of it was pretty scary. And I think most of that has to do with the lead performance in this movie, because she's so great and so much fun to watch, and Neil Jordan really lets her go in this. But I think it's well made. I think it's creepy, and I thought the story was well told, and it was a nice, well made, really well directed salute to those 90s thrillers that we were just talking about. So I'm recommending it. Nobody's going to see it, which we'll talk about in a couple of seconds here. But there you go. So next week, obviously, now, Eric, you're going to be going to the South by Southwest Film Festival, correct?
Yes, I will.
So you'll be covering that for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the big one, obviously, next week is Captain Marvel with the lovely Brie Larson.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I'm looking forward to talking about that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could talk about Brie Larson anytime, anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I just think I think she's fantastic. So we'll do that next week, Jim.
Okay.
All right, buddy. Take care.
You
all
too,
right.
Man.
Okay, take care. All right, Eric, you hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll quickly just cover the box office here on 720 WGN.
Silent movie evening, shooting flickers of
light. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about celebrity crushes and really memorable and classic TV characters. Our phone number and text line is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We did the Monday morning movie reviews, and now Eric Childress is going to stick around, and we're going to talk about the box office. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, so How to Train Your Dragon, a second week in a row.
Mm-hmm.
I made $30 million this weekend, and it's up to about $98 million total. How is that compared to the other two?
It's faltering a bit domestically. After the big $55 million opening, which was the biggest opening of the bunch, it a 45% drop, which is a little high for an animated film.
Mm.
Even with an opening like that, $30 million is still a pretty decent second weekend. Historically, it looks like it's probably going to come in under the $177 million that the second film did.
Mm.
It's got some competition in the next couple of weeks, including Captain Marvel this week, that's going to take some people away from the movie.
Right.
Internationally, it's still doing very well. It's made over $375 million worldwide. The film is going to be a success, definitely thanks to its international numbers.
Yeah.
And the U.S. number is going to be kind of fine. It's not drowning out the way the Lego movie is, which is really unfortunate.
It is.
But it's going to be a hit. Just not going to be after last week what people thought that it's a movie that could possibly get up to $200 million. That doesn't look to be the case anymore.
Okay. All right. Number two, Tyler Perry's A Medea Family Funeral, $27 million. This is pretty high for recent Tyler Perry movies, correct?
Recent ones, yes. But you put Madea in the title, and these movies do very well.
Yeah.
And the Madea movies, of all the ones that he's done that has Madea front and center on the title, the average opening weekend for those movies is $26.7 million.
Mm.
So this is pretty much right in line with that average. So this movie's going to come in somewhere between around $50 to $60 million. I don't have a full budget on this one. The budgets on these movies have gone up over time. This is one reason why they kind of paused in making them for a while, because they weren't doing as well.
Right.
But now that he's saying that this is the last Madea movie, I don't know if that's a good idea for him.
Yeah.
He should just keep making Madea movies, and they'll do well enough to make another one.
Yeah. Number three, Alita: Battle Angel, $7 million. It's up to $72 million. What was the budget on this thing?
$170 million is what they're saying on that. And that could also be a lowball figure as well. Some have pegged it closer to $200 million.
Oh.
But even with $170 million, this is a movie that's going to need about another $160 million to break even. So it's all looking at its international dollars at this point. And again, it's doing quite well internationally, but it's not going to do a whole lot more stateside. It's not going to make $100 million here.
Yeah.
So it's going to be all dependent on the international bucks to save this movie.
Number four, the Lego Movie 2, so disappointing. $6.6 million.
Yeah. This is every single week. It looked like, okay, it's going to do this much, and then the next week, I'm like, no, it's going to do less than that, and then this week it's going to do even less than that. I mean, this movie is going to come in around $105 to $110 million. The Lego Batman movie made $170-some million.
Wow.
So this is a real comedown for a series that was shot out of the cannon with Lego Movie, did very well with the follow-up. That Ninjago movie, I don't know if that completely waned interest in the series or whatever, but why this movie got abandoned so quickly. I mean, okay, How to Train Your Dragon took a little wind out of the sails a couple weeks into it, but I'm really kind of surprised that it didn't open better and didn't hold better the second week.
Yeah. Number five, Green Book got a nice boost from the Academy Awards.
It sure did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so now over, movies that when award season started looked like, it was barely going to make $40 million.
Yeah,
and now it's made over $75 million.
I know. I'm surprised. I guess. I mean, but I just still. I like that movie. Number six, Fighting with My Family. Ugh.
Yeah,
it's only made about $15 million in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the wrestling fans are not, maybe that contingent is not as big as we might think, or just not going to the movies so much. I mean, Paige, is she, like, completely out? No, I know she's not wrestling anymore, but
is she even
a staple?
She makes appearances on SmackDown now.
Okay.
She's like the general manager of SmackDown or whatever, but she is in the ring, and she does do promos and stuff pretty regularly. I think she's been off for a few weeks now because of this movie. I think she's been on the road and stuff.
Yeah, right.
So, All right, let's see. Isn't It Romantic with $4.6 million? Greta, wow. Well, nobody really expected it to make a lot of money, right?
Yeah, no, I look at there's definitely glass half full, half empty ways to look at it. I'm definitely on the half empty side. Focus doesn't always release their movies wide opening weekend. And of movies that they've opened wide in 2,000 screens, this is the lowest opening weekend they've ever had.
Wow.
But at the same time, they released a Neil Jordan movie in over 2,000 screens opening weekend.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true.
You know?
If you look at it that way, yeah, that's true. You know, and I had no idea Neil Jordan had a movie.
The movie premiered at Toronto last year, and it was actually, I would have covered it, except it was like the one movie that I ended up not getting a ticket for, so I couldn't fit it into my schedule.
Yeah.
Heard more people were kind of more Jim and I on the film when it premiered there.
Yeah.
But Focus snatched up really quickly, and I'm really surprised how quickly they got it into theaters and put an Isabelle Huppert-led film in over 2,000 screens.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, look, next week, obviously, what are we looking at in terms of Captain Marvel? What are we looking at? What are you projecting?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot higher than they're projecting right now. A couple weeks ago, they were saying it was definitely going to do over $100 million. Some people are saying now $125. I could see this in the 130s, maybe even low 140 region. I think this movie's going to have a wide appeal. Obviously, all the Marvel fans will be out there. At least the ones that aren't, they don't think girls are icky. Those fans that are out there.
Well, you know,
idiots.
And again, and now historically, the female led superhero movie is legit. You know what I mean? And that crowd that crowd is going to be really happy to see this movie. So
yeah, that's why I think that this movie is going to have that broad appeal towards it, and I think a lot of little girls are going to be going to see this movie. They're really going to have a champion with Brie Larson. She's out there promoting the hell out of this thing. This is going to be the biggest movie of the year to date.
Yeah.
Obviously, as it opens, and I think this is a movie. I mean, $300 million, I think, is undeniable. I wouldn't be surprised that this movie approaches Hunger Games numbers.
Wow. Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on that. All right, Eric, you have a great trip in South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, and you'll check in with us to do some exclusive reviews, correct?
You got it.
All right, Eric, safe travels, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, see you later. Eric Childress, he'll be joining us again next week, but we'll have him live from Austin, and he'll be doing some check-ins from the South by Southwest Film Festival. But Jim will be here to review all the new stuff for next week. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Right now we're going to take a break, and we'll come back after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back. Do you know what movie this is from?
Of course I do, Nick. Come on.
The closing credits to Cruising.
Yes, sir. And also from Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof.
Death Proof, right.
Yeah. Right. But I love Cruising.
Yeah. I just haven't, that's very unusual. I just haven't heard that. I remember, the controversy when that movie came out, when Cruising came out. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. I've interviewed William Friedkin a couple of times, and we talked about that movie and the problems that it caused and how he had to recut it and change it and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so there you go. Nice job there, Tom.
Thank you.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. And we're going to jump into some celebrity crushes. Who are your celebrity crush? You can call us or text us right now at 312-981-7200. We also have some celebrities who had celebrity crushes, and we want to hear from you guys. So 312-981-7200, talk or text. Let's see. Here's Ike on WGN. Hi, Ike. Go ahead.
Hey, Nick. How's it going? What's
your name? All right.
Okay. She's not my number one, but it's someone who I discovered recently on a Netflix movie. I had no idea who she was. I thought she was a newcomer, but I looked her up. I saw, oh, this woman's so like in her 40s. And what shocked me even more is what I discovered her. I was like, that was that girl. I'm talking about Vanessa Shaw from Hocus Pocus.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She's been around for a long time, Mike.
Oh my God. Yeah. She is gorgeous. I looked her up. She was in Eyes Wide Shut. She was in, and 40 days, 40 nights. But she's mostly known for Hocus Pocus. She looks good. She's like in her 40s. She looks amazing.
Yeah, she's beautiful. She's beautiful. All right, Ike. Thanks, man.
No problem.
All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you have a celebrity crush. Do you remember your first celebrity crush, Tom?
Yeah, I want to say the earliest one I can remember is I don't know the actress's name, but she was the Pink Ranger in the Power Rangers.
Oh, that's Kimberly. It's Amy Jo Johnson.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
She was on Felicity.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh God, that's good to hear that she had a career past it.
She was on Felicity. That's what I know her from. But yeah, that's Amy Jo Johnson. She had a singing career.
She fought monsters. Did the whole thing.
Yeah. So there she is. Okay. That makes sense. She's adorable. Well, I'm much older than you. And the first trio of crushes that I can remember when I was a little kid, when I was young, and this is going to date me right now. You guys are going to figure out. You guys already know how old I am, I think, but this is certainly going to date me. These were like the first three crushes that I had when I was a young kid. And it was Haley Mills, and I think a lot of guys my age had a crush on Haley Mills. I think that was a real common one. Haley Mills was this young actress. She was a kid. She made a bunch of Disney movies, and then would go on to be in the original series before it became Saved by the Bell. She was on that, and that's Haley Mills. And along the same time, I had a crush on Yvonne Craig, who was Batgirl on the Adam West Batman. So I had a massive crush on Haley Mills, Yvonne Craig, Batgirl from Batman, and then Barbara Feldon. A lot of people don't know who she was, but she was Agent 99 on Get Smart. She was the love interest for Don Adams on Get Smart, and I had a massive crush on her. But that dates me right there. You can pretty much figure out how old I am with those. Those were the three first crushes I had when I was a little kid. Haley Mills, Yvonne Craig, Batgirl, and Agent 99, Barbara Feldon. So there you go.
Very 60s chic.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
She rocks the turtleneck really well.
Which one?
Barbara Feldon.
Barbara Feldon, beautiful woman.
I've got a picture of her on IMDb. She was in a movie called Fitzwillie.
Yes.
In 1967. She's pulling the Velma, little Scooby-Doo look there.
Yeah, yeah. She was really something. She was great. And I had such a crush on her on Get Smart. I really did. And but my ultimate crush is, without question, is Jamie Lee Curtis. Jamie Lee Curtis, man. The first time I saw Halloween, the movie came out in 1978, I was 13 years old. So I'm a 13-year-old boy. And I fell in love with Jamie Lee Curtis. And then, you know, when she did those series of horror movies in the late 70s and the early 80s, she was a scream queen in like 5-6 movies in
like
a row.
Prom Night and everything.
She was Prom Night, Terror Train. She was in The Fog, Halloween 2. And that's my favorite genre. Horror is my favorite genre. And so I was just in love with her, man. Oh, my God. I had a massive crush on her. What's really funny and kind of ironic is that, you know, she started her career, she was 18 when she made Halloween. So she started her career doing these slasher movies, you know, and a lot of these slasher movies, as you know, from the 70s and 80s, had like, you know, they were gory and everything. And of course they had boobs, sure. They had boobs in them and everything, yeah. Because that was the thing. She never once took her top off in any of those movies. Then she makes Trading Places, which is just a straightforward, Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd comedy, and boom, there goes the shirt. And I was like, so wait a minute, you make like six exploitation movies in a row, and then you're like in a big budget Paramount comedy, you know? I mean, I'm not complaining, but I just found that kind of weird.
Even in A Fish Called Wanda, she went into like some pretty risque dress.
Yeah, yeah. But it was Trading Places where I was like, wow, all right.
Okay. This is how we're doing it.
All right. All right. Let's see. 773 Erica. We got some celebrity crush texts here. And if you want to join us, the phone lines are open. The text lines are open. We're talking about your celebrity crushes, even if you have one now. 773 Erica. My first celebrity crush was, Jenny Garth from 90210. I was four.
early bloomer.
Yeah. Well, I was around 5 when the Barbara Feldon thing was happening.
Wow.
Yeah. Yvonne Craig, too, man. Batgirl. Mm. You can't, I mean, sheesh. Wow. 906 area code says Linda Carter, Cheryl Ladd, yowza. That's someone who's close to my age, clearly. If you're going Linda Carter, Cheryl Ladd, that's a 70s time. Yeah. 952 area code says my crush, Herman of Hermits Hermits. And my heart still flutters. Really? That's an unusual one. Herman from Herman and the Hermits. Wow. Okay.
He had, very British invasion.
Yeah, well, very British invasion and very weird haircut, too. Okay. All right, we have some celebrities who have celebrity crushes. And if you guys want to jump in here, 312-981-7200. Well, currently, my main celebrity crush right now is my future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo. From Ash vs. Evil Dead. She's my real crush. So she's my future ex-wife. So Dana, you know, I hope she's listening, but she's probably not. But anyway, so that's my current major crush, like for real. Let's see. Chad Michael Murray. You guys all know Chad Michael Murray? He was on One Tree Hill. And his major crush was Madonna. I can't blame him. Can't blame him. You got to love Madonna. The One Tree Hill heartthrob has serious feelings for Madonna. I remember I was a little boy and, oh, I can't tell this story exactly the way I want to tell it, Chad shared in an interview with Young Hollywood. But let's just say I realized I was like, what, huh? That was different. And at this point, the actor looks not so discreetly down, if you get my drift. So inappropriate. So something happened down there when he saw Madonna, and the movie that set him off was Dick Tracy. So Chad Michael Murray from One Tree Hill, his number one crush, Madonna. I bet that's true of a lot of people. Yeah. All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number for Talk and Text, and we are talking crushes, and here's Scott on WGN. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Nick, welcome back. Your voice sounds much better this week.
Thanks, man.
Hey, no problem. These were all first-run episodes I saw. It was Susan Day and Maureen McCormick.
Yeah, now, you and I, how old are you? We got to be close in the same age, right, Scott?
I'm 61.
Oh, okay, I'm 53. And I remember the Susan Day on the Partridge Family big time.
Yeah. And then she came back in L.A. Law.
She did. Yeah, yeah, she
yeah.
did.
Yeah,
had quite a set, yeah, quite but, a, had quite a had quite a career. So Susan Day and Maureen McCormick. All right, thank you, Scott.
No problem.
Take care. These are. It's also really funny because these totally. I mean, if these were childhood crushes, you know, because you have crushes on. I still get crushes on actresses and stuff.
Sure,
absolutely. Wait a minute. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Nick. Hey, listen. Tanya Roberts, she was the last Charlie's Angel. There were 6 of them, actually, and she was the last one. I'm 56, but Susan Day was one of my favorite, too. But she was also, Susan Day was in a movie with William Catt called First Love.
Right.
Nobody remembers that. I saw that at the movie theater.
Yeah, no, I remember it. I absolutely remember it, yeah.
Oh, my God. Thank God, yeah. But, I mean, but Tanya Roberts was really hot besides Cheryl Ladd. You know, Cheryl Ladd, I thought she was in, she did the vocals for Josie and the Pussycats. Did you know that?
Did I know what?
Cheryl Ladd.
Yeah.
You know, everybody talks about Cheryl. She was hot, too, when, you know, Charlie's Angels. She was one of the vocalists for Josie and the Pussycats.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. No, I didn't know that. Did not know that. Okay. All right, Mike. Thanks, man.
You got it, man.
All right. Tanya Roberts, by the way, if you've not seen the movie The Beastmaster, you should do yourself a favor and see the movie The Beastmaster. That's all I'm saying. If you're a Tanya Roberts fan, just it's an entertaining movie. It's a goofy ass movie. Don Coscarelli wrote and directed it, who did the Phantasm movies, who's a good friend of the show. But yeah, Tanya Roberts, there you go. Okay, first crushes, everybody, like celebrity crush, 312-981-7200 for Talk and Text. Text them in or call them in. And I'll give you some more celebrities who had crushes on celebrities as well. 312-981-7200. It's backcourt battle. It's a backcourt battle as the Bulls look to polish off the Pacers in Indy. Bulls, Pacers, Tuesday at 6 on WGN TV Sports. I don't want you. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Yeah. A little fog hat Monday morning. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Nick DiGilio, I'm your overnight dude, and we're here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning, which means in a little while my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And, of course, we have the Blackhawks Express from last night's game. Rough road trip for the Hawks. They're having a rough season, actually, and but we'll play back the Express coming up a little bit later on. Right now, we are talking about celebrity crushes. Who was your first celebrity crush when you were a kid? And if you've got a celebrity crush now, we want to hear from you. The phone lines are open. The text lines are open. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Here is Dominic on WGN. Hi, Dominic.
Hi. This is Jamie Lee Curtis' actual story. I had a crush on her. Anyway, I got to the kisser once, and I'll give you the story. She was making a movie in Pontiac, Illinois in 1983 called Grandview, USA.
Yep.
And then they said she was raising money in the town for the little girl had a heart operation. So I went down there, got a good chance to kiss her. She was a kissing booth, and also got to take a picture with her. And also there was C. Thomas Howell. And
Patrick Swayze.
Yeah. Oh, she was sweet. Very sweet.
I've got to meet her. I got to meet her and I got to kiss her, too. It was crazy because Roy Leonard, the great Roy Leonard, had Jamie Lee Curtis on his show with director Kathryn Bigelow. They were in town promoting Blue Steel, the great cop movie that Kathryn Bigelow directed and Jamie Lee Curtis appeared in. And so, you know, Roy, everybody who knows me is aware of my massive crush on Jamie Lee Curtis, and it's been forever. I mean, it's like, you know, when you think Nick DiGilio, you think crush on Jamie Lee Curtis. That's what, especially in my teenage years and in my 20s. So to have the opportunity to actually meet her was pretty ridiculous. And so she comes in, Kathryn Bigelow comes in. And by the way, if you've not seen what Kathryn Bigelow looks like, now we all know she's a fantastic director, first woman to win the Best Director Oscar for The Hurt Locker, and she's made some incredible movies, including some that are criminally underrated that not many people have seen. Tom, I'm assuming you've seen Strange Days?
I haven't seen Strange Days, but did she do Near Dark?
She did Near Dark.
Near Dark is near and dear to my heart.
One of the greatest movies ever made.
Oh, it's amazing. Bill Paxton.
The late, great Bill Paxton. Amazing. Finger-licking good. that, to me, and this is I personally think that's the best vampire movie ever made.
I think it's in the running.
Yeah. I think it's the best vampire movie ever made, and they never used the word vampire in it.
No.
It's more like a Western. It's more like the inspiration was like the Wild Bunch is what it feels like. And Lance Hendrickson, man, is the king.
Oh, yeah. It felt like Lost Boys, but like grown up.
No, it was like Lost Boys, but good.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
I've got a soft spot for Lost Boys. I think there's something very 80s about it.
I hate that movie. And one of the reasons I hate it is, well, because I just think it's stupid, but One of the things that I hate about the movie is that when Near Dark came out, Near Dark had the unfortunate problem of being released like about 3 weeks or a month after. By the way, Dominic, thanks for the call. Jamie Lee Curtis rules. 3 weeks to a month after Lost Boys. So Near Dark got compared to Lost Boys, and it didn't make any money. It made no money. Near Dark made no money. And so it had that unfortunate timing of coming out like about a month after The Lost Boys.
Right.
And so everybody was like, oh, it's like a Lost Boys ripoff. It's like, no, it's not. It's a complete.
It's so much more. It's so intense, and it's so well directed. She's
a great director.
Especially for action. Yeah. She's got just the eye for it. Point Break.
One of the greatest movies ever made.
Boom.
But so when I met her, if you've seen her, she's gorgeous. She's drop-dead gorgeous. She's like statuesque, beautiful woman. And so I have a picture, and my parents have it framed actually in their living room, of me between Jamie Lee Curtis and Catherine Bigelow with the goofiest look on my face, because it's like two of these women. And so, you know, this was pre-Point Break. So it was post Near Dark, because it was the Blue Steel was their follow-up to Near Dark. So Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, so Roy Leonard, God bless him, decides to I'm sitting in on the interview because he knows that I'm a fan of both of these women. And we had both seen Blue Steel. We both liked it very much. And so we're conducting the interview. And then Roy goes out of his way to tell Jamie Lee Curtis about my crush on her. Like, on purpose. And from that point on, Jamie Lee Curtis played it up. Like, she was kissing me. She was, like, touching me. She was talking all sexy to me. And I was beat red, man. It was ridiculous. But Roy did that on purpose, and she rolled with it, man. She totally rolled with it.
Roy, you sly dog.
Oh, it was cool, though, man. I'll tell you, it was cool. I got to smooch with Jamie Lee Curtis, and that was pretty cool. But yeah, and it was awesome. You know, you're a fan of Point Break.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to tell the whole story because I've told it a bunch of times. But I ended up spending a week hanging out with Gary Busey.
Now, where in the timeline is this for Gary Busey? Because
it's when he was shooting. He was in town shooting that stupid movie where the kid breaks his arm and then starts pitching for the Cubs.
Rookie of the Year?
Right. So he was in town. It was 92.
Okay.
Fall of 92.
So this is post motorcycle accident, like past that.
This is post Point Break. This was about a year after Point Break.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
So I was dating a girl at the time who was really, really hot and I had no business being with her. So she liked to go to clubs and she could get into VIP because of the way she looked.
Okay.
So we ended up going to China Club, and we got into the VIP room, walked into the VIP room. I look across the room, and there's Gary Busey. So I'm like, it's Gary Busey. And she's like, I don't know who that is. And I'm like, this relationship's not going to last very long. You don't know who Gary Busey is. So I went up to Gary Busey, and I was like, I was hesitant. I didn't want to bother him. And I said, look, I don't mean to bother you or anything, but I am a really, really big fan of your work, and you were great in Point Break. And his eyes lit up. He went, Point Break, that was one of the greatest movies I've ever made. And he started telling me stories about Point Break behind the scenes, and he took a liking to me, and we ended up hanging out like every night. He was staying at the Westin Hotel across from the Hancock Building. So, yeah. No, we only got... And just whatever you think it is to hang out with Gary Busey, you know, whatever weird things you think immediately, quadruple that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to ask him about Predator 2. I've got a soft spot
Predator
for it.
Predator 2 is awesome, man.
It's great, but, I mean, the lions and tigers and bears speech he gives, it's great.
One of the other great things about that week was that was when Under Siege came out.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So he's in town, and I got an invite from Warner Brothers to a screening of it. Mm-hmm. And so I was talking to him, and I was like, you know, there's a screening of Under Siege tonight. He's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, there's a screening right at the Esquire, which is right down the street from where you're staying. And he's like, I didn't know there was going to have a screening. And I'm like, yeah, there's a screening tonight, and I'm going. And he's like, you think I can get in? And I'm like, you're in the movie. I actually think you can get in. You're in the damn movie. And then I go, well, why don't you just come as my plus one? So he went with me. I saw Under Siege with Gary Busey sitting next to me doing like DVD commentary through the whole movie.
Have you considered writing at least an article instead of My Week with Marilyn, my week with Gary?
Yeah.
I think there's a picture deal in there for you.
I got to tell you. But it was so amazing. Like, he's like, we improvised this scene. Me and Tommy Lee Jones improvised this scene. There's a scene in the movie where he comes out in drag. And he goes, I wanted to do this in drag. I had to convince the director to let me do it in drag. That was like constant. He was talking about how much of a jerk Steven Seagal was.
Oh, that goes without saying. That's incredible.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was a very weird week, man. I was exhausted. That's all I'm saying. 404 area code says, like every guy my age, Jennifer Love Hewitt. Yeah, I can understand that. All right, let's take a break here. We've got more stuff coming out here. 312-981-7200. Celebrity crushes is what we're talking about. We also have some more celebrities who have celebrity crushes. So we're being real meta this morning. All right, let's take a break. We got the news coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And, yeah, we're going to talk about great TV characters as well. But right now we're talking about celebrity crushes. Who was your first celebrity crush? Vic, did you have a celebrity crush when you were younger?
Oh, man. I'm sure I did. I'm trying... Go to Tom. Let me think. Nothing's coming to me off the bat. I mean, I'm sure I did.
Yeah. Okay.
I was big into Kristen Dunst in Jumanji.
Oh, okay.
Because that came out when I was a child, so I was smitten with her.
Had you seen Interview with a Vampire yet?
Not until after.
Yeah. Because she's unbelievable in that movie.
Top 10 child performances.
Absolutely. Without question. Without question. You know what else is another incredible child performance? I mean, there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
But Christian Bale in Empire of the Sun is unbelievable in that movie.
I mean, and that's a huge Spielberg studio picture. I mean, everything's going on. And Christian Bale, he did it.
He carried it all on his shoulders. What was he, like 12 when he made that movie?
If that.
God. It's such a great performance. I remember just going, who the hell is this kid? I mean... And he's still amazing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's consistently great. He's become even better. Mm-hmm. So, but that's one of my favorites. But Kirsten Dunst, man, when I saw Interview, I was like, whoa.
And then I got older, and she was in Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I was, like, ripe for the age of Spider-Man. I was like, wow, Mary Jane, that'd be so cool.
Yeah. Did you see Melancholia?
Yeah. And I'm not, that's Von Trier, yeah?
Yeah.
I'm not always super into Von Trier, but I liked it.
I did too. I can't stand Von Trier usually.
Yeah.
I'm
not big into Antichrist.
No, God, no. It was the longest 2 hours of my life.
Oof.
I'm just not, you know, and he's got some serial killer movie out now with Matt Dillon.
Yeah, The House that Jack Built.
Yeah, I got no interest.
I
got no interest, man.
But it's got all your favorite things. It's got killers, blood.
Yeah.
But it's very Von Trier. I can't
deal with that anymore. I got to the point where I was like, I can't watch this. It was those two nymphomaniac movies. I was like, okay, I can't.
I saw Shia LaBeouf and I was like, I'll skip it.
Yeah.
I'll skip it.
Yeah. But anyway, we were talking about first crushes, and I've got some celebrity crush texts here from our listeners. And by the way, the phone lines are open and the text lines are open. Who was your first celebrity crush? Who's your celebrity crush now? 312-981-7200. 630 area code says, my celebrity crushes are Davy Jones, Peter Noon, Bobby Sherman, and Robert Redford. Okay, that's a specific time period, too. 309 area code, all the Petticoat Junction girls, and, of course, Barbara Eden. Yeah. 773 area code, my celebrity crush is Olivia Benson from Law & Order SVU. I don't know who that is. I don't watch Law & Order SVU. 708. Oh, yeah. This is a big one. I agree with this one 100%. We've got to be around the same age. 708 area code. Kim Richards from Escape to Witch Mountain. Absolutely. Massive crush on Kim Richards. And now she's one of those idiot housewives, Kim Richards. She was in Escape to Witch Mountain, Disney movie from the mid-70s, and I had a massive crush on her. She was also on a sitcom called Hello, Larry. And she was in a terrible early James Spader movie called Tough Turf. T-U-F-F, Tough Turf. Robert Downey Jr.'s in it, too.
What's that even about?
Soccer? James Spader. No, James Spader plays it. Gets a gang movie. James Spader moves. He's a new guy in town.
Okay.
Falls for Kim Richards, who happens to be the girlfriend of one of the ruffians. And it's really truly one of the worst movies you've ever seen. It also has James Spader singing a song called "I Walk the Night," but it's him. He's lip syncing to some other guy, but he's like very, very like romantically singing the song at a party that everybody's at. And he's playing the piano, and it's one of the funniest things. You can find.
I was going to say, are you sure that's the worst movie?
You could find it on YouTube, man.
Just I'm going to have to look that up.
Look up James Spader, "I Walk the Night," and just and enjoy yourself. And this was a mid-80s movie, so the clothes are fantastic. It's, yeah.
Top 10.
Tough turf.
Nick, I was going back over, I was looking up some things on the internet, yeah. And I think, without a doubt, it's Farrah Fawcett for me.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've looked at the actresses of the 70s and 80s, and without a doubt, you know, it took me a minute, but yeah, definitely. And you were talking about Logan's Run the other day. I
right.
think it was that movie that really caught my eye of Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
Okay, so Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah, childhood crush.
Childhood crush.
On the big screen, definitely.
There you go. All right, here's Paul on WGN. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
The one that really, really knocked my eyes out, 1968, was Wanda Ventum. She was in a TV show in 1968 called UFO. She, by the way, is Benedict Cumberbatch's mother.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
Oh. Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I would have to look her up because right off the top of my head, the name doesn't ring a bell.
Well, she's been in a lot of British movies, a lot of probably some of the Hammer movies that you've been into. So you probably would recognize her down the line.
If she did Hammer movies, then I definitely have seen her.
Yeah, at some point along the line, but it was UFO that grabbed me.
Okay, very cool. All right, Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
Just went off the beaten path right there. But if she starred in Hammer movies, then I definitely have seen her.
Yeah, she also appeared in a couple episodes of The Saint with Roger Moore.
Roger Moore, yeah. Here's Bill on WGN. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, I'm going to go way back before even born. I like Sandra Dee.
Oh, sure, Sandra Dee.
She did all those beach scenes. Man, we used to sit in the drive-in and drool watching those movies.
Sit in the drive-in and drool. Yeah, there you go.
Right.
That sounds like fun.
All right. Yeah, that's way before your time.
Yeah, not way before my time, Bill. I remember Sandra Dee just a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, well, when she got older, but I'm talking about like, you know, 55, 56
yeah.
into there, right? You
yeah.
know, or even, you know, right that time. You know.
All right, Bill. Thanks.
All right,
Sandra Dee,
the classic beach party movie.
Yeah. Well, you got the Annette Funicello too. A lot of people had crushes on Annette Funicello when mm-hmm. she was a Mouseketeer too. I remember people around. I guess it would probably be around my dad's age talking about how, as a kid watching the Mickey Mouse Club, there was a distinct development change in Annette Funicello. And Annette Funicello, like right around the third season of the second season, it was like, whoa.
Hold up.
What's going on there?
The Mickey Mouse Club, they've got a good track record with...
Even the modern one, yeah.
Yeah. Justin Timberlake, yeah. Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Christina Aguilera.
Britney Spears.
Oh, Britney, yeah.
Speaking of Britney Spears, that's the crush I have next here. Britney Spears has a crush on Brad Pitt. Like, there's a shocker.
Yeah, so join the club.
Britney Spears has a well-documented crush on Brad Pitt and even had a treasured framed picture of herself with Brad displayed in her living room. We shouldn't share that. I'm embarrassed, she told Diane Sawyer back in 2003. But that's my little thing. Even though Brit is happy with boyfriend Sam Asghari, she never wavered in her love for Brad. In the wake of Brad's divorce with Angelina Jolie, Britney brought up her first true love. My celebrity crush was Brad Pitt, and she said to Australia's Today, and he's single now.
Be careful.
Yeah.
I've seen Angelina Jolie do horrendous things to people on film.
Yeah. Ashley Olsen of the Olsen twins had a crush on Brad Pitt. And Mary-Kate, however, favored Andy Roddick, the tennis player. Yeah.
I mean, you know, athletes.
Another Brad Pitt loyalist, Ashley Olsen, she first discussed her crush on The Rosie O'Donnell Show through the ups and downs, declared him her main man on Vanity Fair's It's Raining Teen spread. Mary-Kate name-checked tennis player Andy Roddick, but want to know who her favorite party boy was? Heath Ledger.
Hmm.
So
well, he was really something back in the day. I know 10 Things I Hate About You was massive for him. Knight's Tale,
yeah,
very dreamy and Australian.
Yeah,
the accent works.
Ashton Kutcher, Jennifer Aniston is his crush. I think there's a lot of people who have a crush on Jennifer Aniston. Ashton Kutcher had eyes for America's sweetheart as a teen and even waged money that he would make Jennifer Aniston his. I made a bet when I was in high school. You have to imagine I'm living on a farm in the middle of America, Ashton explained on the Graham Norton show, and really having no chance of having a happy life. And I've sort of succumbed to this, so the best ideas I have are sitting around in basements making bets about what we would do someday. So I make a bet with my buddy. I'm probably 17 years old. I say to him, I bet you $1,000 that someday I will go on a date with Jennifer Aniston. I'm a 17-year-old in Iowa, and she's like my screensaver on my computer at the time. And he's like, yeah, you're on. That day came when, 4 or 5 years later, Ashton asked Jennifer, with then-husband Brad Pitt's blessing, out for pizza. She understandably shrugged off his advances, but the two could now be considered friends.
Hmm.
Well, so did he get the $1,000 from the other? Did he get the $1,000 from the guy who made the bet?
I guess we'll never know. I wonder how Mila Kunis feels about that.
Yeah.
Because they met pretty early in their respective careers.
Yeah.
Is that settling for him?
Well, oh, I mean, you know, he had the whole Demi Moore thing for
that's true.
For a long time. How about this? Lindsay Lohan has a crush on Ashton Kutcher.
Huh.
You know who was willing to give Ashton a shot, though? Lindsay Lohan in her prime, naming Ashton Kutcher as a celebrity crush back in 2003. That definitely paid off since Lilo guest starred on that 70s show the following year. Years later, Ashton took a spot on her celebrity lover list. What does that mean? So I guess they got together.
Do you think that celebrities just kind of sit around Hollywood when they're bored, like, which other celebrities would work for me?
Zac Efron had a crush on Tyra Banks. Once upon a time, only one American top model mattered to Zac Efron, and that was Tyra Banks. When I was younger, I used to lie on my bed and look up at a poster of Tyra Banks on my ceiling. He shared that in 2010. Do we really need to hear that?
That's a little personal.
She was in the Victoria's Secret catalogs that my mom used to get, and I thought she was the most gorgeous thing in the world. In 2013, Tyra caught a whiff of this little infatuation and tweeted at Zefron, I'll see you, Ty. She also asked fans, should I call him?
Hmm. I wonder if this is where he drew on the experience to play Ted Bundy.
Yeah. I don't know.
A little creep factor.
How about this? Milo Ventimiglia had a crush on Cindy Crawford. Gilmore Girl bad boy Jess turned This Is Us dream dad Jack. He had a penchant for co-stars in the past, dating both Alexis Bledel and Heroes castmate Hayden Panettiere. The first woman to catch his eye was supermodel Cindy Crawford. I had her calendar when I was a kid, and I saw her. I don't have the calendar now, but I saw her at a party, and I was like, wow, she's still smoking. Yes, Milo had feelings for Cindy in the same way Chad had feelings for Madonna. We call them feelings. We can't call them anything else in a teenage boy's life. Since then, he gravitates towards sharp, witty, and kind women with their own sense of style. Okay.
Seems like a nice enough guy.
Yeah. Well, he's a Jess on the Gilmore Girls. He's always going to be a jerk. Jess. I hated Jess.
I miss the Gilmore Girls wave. All I know is that it's about two women talking really fast and drinking a lot of coffee.
Right, mother and daughter.
Mother and daughter, yeah.
Right. It's one of the best shows ever.
Really? I owe it to myself, though.
I was obsessed with the Gilmore Girls. Obsessed. When it came back on Netflix a couple of years back, I watched the whole 8 hours in one sitting.
Just as good?
Yeah. Fantastic.
I guess you can't keep a good show down.
Well, there was a season when, you know, when a showrunner leaves a show, sometimes it takes a hit in quality. You know what I mean? And there was a time period where Amy Sherman-Palladino, who currently has The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Spectacular
Which
show.
Is a great show.
Amazing.
She left for a while, and the Gilmore Girls took a big hit. There were a couple of seasons where it was rough. And the last season was shaky, but the final episode itself was pretty great. So, but yeah, no, that show's great. The show is great.
All right, I'll put it on the
list.
You know who else
is obsessed with it like I am? Patty Vasquez.
You know, I think she's definitely mentioned it before.
Yeah.
And I've been woefully underinformed on the ways
because,
of the girls.
It's funny because we are the two people on this radio station who talk the fastest. Patty talks the fastest of anybody. But I think that has something to do with why we like Gilmore Girls so much.
You got a kindred spirit.
Speed talking. So, all right, let's take a break. Celebrity crushes, everybody. Get your texts in. Get your calls in at 312-981-7200. That's coming up after this. All right. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How you doing? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and I'm your overnight dude here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. How's it going? We're here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. We got the Blackhawks Express from last night's game to play back and more. Right now we're talking about celebrity crushes. Who were yours? 312-981-7200. And we've been talking about celebrities and their celebrity crushes. So let's get into that. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Here's Maggie on WGN. Hi, Maggie.
Yes. James Darren in Time Tunnel. 1966. Your first crush when you're 12 years old.
Yeah. Time Tunnel.
Yes, and then T.J. Hooker, and then finally 30 years later in Deep Space Nine and Star Trek, and he's still singing, and he's still gorgeous.
Wow, look at that. All right, great one, Maggie. Thanks for the call.
Okay,
Take care. There you go. So, Jared Padalecki, who also wanted the love of Rory Gilmore in the Gilmore Girls. And he's been on Supernatural. That show's been on for 53 years. I think it's been on like 16, 17 years.
Yeah. It's got a ridiculously long fan base.
Yeah, it does. Huge. They're very, very serious. I interviewed Curtis Armstrong and who was on Supernatural. And he says that the fan conventions, the Supernatural fan conventions, you know, are 15 times crazier than any other intense convention. You know, they're really dedicated, mm-hmm. and they really love the show. And it's been on forever.
Yeah, I think I can barely remember when it premiered, and I thought, wow, this is kind of a weird, dark TV show. And then you see where it goes. It just gets ridiculous. I think they kill God at some point.
I have no idea.
It just goes off the rails.
But Jared Padalecki is Jennifer Love Hewitt. That's his crush.
That's an excellent choice.
Yeah, I agree. He said, you're probably going to laugh your ass off when I tell you this, but it was actually Jennifer Love Hewitt, he shared in an interview. I was obsessed with her when I was 16. Yeah, I can see that. I can understand the Jennifer Love Hewitt thing.
Was she Party of Five?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just a gorgeous cast.
Everybody, yeah.
And she's in Scream.
It's Neve Campbell.
Neve Campbell. I have a long-standing, deep appreciation and crush for Neve Campbell.
She came to the Flashback Horror Convention, which I'm one of the hosts of, and they did like a Scream reunion. So Matthew Lillard, Skeet Ulrich, Neve Campbell, and I believe, one other person? Yeah, but anyway, Neve Campbell was there, and I got to meet her, and all I did was talk to her about Party of Five. I loved that show. I didn't even mention Scream, and I love Scream. I think the Scream movies are great, but I just wanted to talk to her about Party of Five, because that was one of the first shows that I saw if people who are regular listeners know this, my tastes in a lot of things also mirror that of a 13-year-old girl. There are a lot of things that I mentioned, Gilmore Girls already, obsessed with that show. Felicity, one of my favorite shows of all time. But it all started with two shows. It all started with the 13-year-old girl inside Nick DiGilio, you know, came to the forefront. Party of Five and My So-Called Life. Those two shows, they were right around the same time. And that was when I let my guard down and was like, okay, I officially like things that 13-year-old girls are supposed to like.
But there's so much about it to like, both of those series.
Because they're both great.
Yeah. It just transcends.
They're both great.
all sorts of things.
My so-called life destroyed me, though, because it was just the one season. And yeah. Jordan Catalano, man. You can't... I still, you know, I don't refer to him as Jared Leto. He's Jordan Catalano. It'll always be Jordan
and all
Catalano.
Be all.
Yeah. So...
That's a role you can't shake.
Here's a weird one. How about this? Emma Watson had a crush on Tom Felton.
No.
So she dug Draco Malfoy.
That actually hurts a little bit.
It does, doesn't it?
I'm not. That doesn't sit well with me. Because I know he's not actually Draco Malfoy, but it's...
You know, no, that's weird, man.
It's super weird.
When I read that, I'm like, no, you can't. You can't like Draco Malfoy. You can't like him. You're Hermione. You can't. It says, this may be a bit of old lore, but way back, Hermione Granger had a thing for Draco Malfoy. For the first two movies, I had a huge crush on Tom Felton, Emma Watson told 17 Magazine. He was my first crush. He totally knows it. We talk about it. We still laugh about it. We're really good friends now, and that's cool. Incidentally, Tom Felton seemed pretty awkward when asked if he knew about the crush that same year. No, he said, laughing nervously. Sorry, I'm being a bit aloof with my answers. So, yeah.
That's a tough break for Daniel Radcliffe and Rupert.
Yeah.
Rupert Grint.
Malfoy. He was also, you know what else he was? You know what, Tom Felton? That Planet of the Apes movie. Oh,
Rise of the Planet.
I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill him in that movie.
Well, I mean, if you're going to cast a kid to be the most despicable person on Earth, you might as well go with the guy who played Draco Malfoy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just that name.
By the way, just speaking of those Planet of the Apes movies, how great are those movies?
Spectacular.
I mean, and where the hell did those movies come from? Because when the first one came out, when Rise came out, it came out of nowhere. Okay, it was like I'd never heard of the director, you know, and it was coming about probably what is it about 8-9 years after the disastrous Tim Burton remake with Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, I pretend it doesn't exist.
And I love the Planet of the Apes movies, the original original Planet of the Apes movies. I grew up.
I got my rubber mask at home, man.
Yeah, I grew up on those. Those are massive parts of my childhood. The Planet of the Apes movies. So I love them. And when I heard about this, I'm like, no, you can't do this. Tim Burton has already screwed it up. What is this? And it was being released at the end of August with no, you know, like fanfare or anything. And you know, you're a movie follower.
Yeah.
They dump a lot of crap in the end of August.
It's a dead zone.
So I remember going into the screening, into the theater going, this is going to suck. Wow. And they just get better. Those three movies are unbelievable.
Once Matt Reeves takes over for Dawn, it was off to the races.
It's just and I mean Andy Serkis, man.
He's the only man that could make you care about the emotional saga of a chimpanzee.
There's no question about it, man.
It's incredible.
Is it? Ugh.
I still watch him all the way through. I'll just start with 1968. Chuck Heston, and just go all the way through.
No, they're all, you know, my favorite, my second favorite, well, my favorite's the first one, but my second favorite is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
There's a lot to like about it.
Which is, that's where the apes
rise up,
yeah. Led by Caesar.
Is that number four?
That's the fourth one.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yes, that's the, no, yes. That's the fourth one, because it's Planet of the Apes, Beneath, Escape.
Conquest.
Battle.
And then they restart.
And then they, yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll talk a little bit more about celebrity crushes if you want to jump in. It's 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How's it going? We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we also have a Blackhawks Express. An unfortunate Blackhawks Express to play back for you later in the show. Our phone number and text number are open right now. You can text or call us at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And we're talking about celebrity crushes. Who were your celebrity crushes? We'll talk more about that. And I also have some more celebrity crushes. Like, for instance, Channing Tatum and Ben McKenzie. Both had a crush on Alyssa Milano. I'm not surprised by that. I think a lot of people had a crush on her.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when she played She played Arnold Schwarzenegger's daughter in Commando when she was just a little kid. And then, of course, she was on Who's the Boss.
Right.
And so I just knew her as the little kid from Who's the Boss, the little kid from Commando. And then I remember seeing this movie with Reese Witherspoon and Mark Wahlberg called Fear. And Alyssa Milano was in it. And I remember watching the movie and going, oh, my God. Because, well, Alyssa Milano grew up and grew up big time. I mean.
Yes.
And that was the first time. That was when I saw that movie Fear. I was like, oh.
I caught her a little bit on Charmed in the mid-2000s.
Yeah. Well, by that point, you know, she had done some sort of, you know, she did like this thing called Embrace of the Vampire where she's half naked through half of the movie. And so that was the late 90s when she did that, when she did those movies, mid to late 90s. But yeah, I vividly remember seeing Fear and going, what? I can't believe that's the girl from Who's the Boss.
Yeah.
I can't. Oh, my God.
Did you ever see the Poison Ivy movies?
Oh, sure.
I know. She was in the second one. She was Lily, right?
Yeah. She was in the second one. It was Drew Barrymore was in the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. That was a weird time for both of them. Drew Barrymore is definitely on the list, though, for big celebrity crushes.
Oh, yeah. Aaron Carter had a crush on Hilary Duff.
Two tween superstars.
Yeah.
A match made in heaven.
Yeah. Nothing could go wrong there.
Never.
No. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to jump in here with your celebrity crushes. We've been talking about some of the other ones that celebrities have. We got a few more here of celebrities who have celebrity crushes. All right. Christy Teigen, wife of course, John Legend. Alex Rodriguez.
That's weak. I mean, I get it. He's a star. But
she said, I grew up in Seattle, and at a time he was 18 or 19 when he was playing, so he was such a young buck. He was my first crush. John and I saw him at Soho House the other day, and I had never seen him in person before, and John is very, very well aware. He was like, your man is over there, and I was so embarrassed. You just never think you're going to run into those people. But John's was Tatiana Ali. I call him out on that one, too. He had posters and everything. Soho House, what a weird place. You ever been there?
No, my brother's really into the scene.
Really?
Isn't it just kind of like a country club of sorts?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cool idea, I guess.
I went there because my future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo, was in town and she was staying there.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, she had to sign me in and everything because it's like exclusive. And it was like high tea at the time when I went in.
Are we still doing high tea?
At the Soho House,
they
do.
At the Soho House, we are.
But yeah, it was just weird. She was staying there and we were like, we hung out there for like, we went all around. We were up on the roof, you know, we just went through there. They got all these weird little rooms and, you know, art installations and stuff. And you can go to a room, there's a bunch of music, you know, instruments, and you can just take it off the wall and start playing. And it's just weird. Not my scene, man. And it's not Dana's scene either. Dana was in town for a wedding, and she knew someone who knew a manager at the Soho House, so they got her in.
Nice.
So, you know, she was... she's going to come over and hang out, and I'm like, all right. She goes, I'm staying at the Soho House, and I'm like, I've never been there before, but I hear it's weird. So, I get there, and Dana comes down and meets me, and she's like, yeah, this place is weird. This place is weird.
Not even, like, revolving bookcase weird? Because I could handle that if it was,
we ate, we had dinner and stuff there. The food was fine. Everything was really expensive, though.
I imagine.
And they said that we were, because I wanted to get a picture of me and Dana.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, we do not allow pictures to be taken at Soho House.
Ah, jeez.
And I'm like, what? So, anyway.
It's for the birds.
It was fun, though. I mean, we had a good time.
Sure, yeah.
You know, because I was hanging out with Dana DiLorenzo, so that's awesome.
Got to pluck a guitar off the wall.
I didn't do any of that.
No?
No.
No stairway?
No.
Not too bad.
Kate Bosworth, by the way. Leo DiCaprio. In Romeo and Juliet. I think every girl thought, I want that crazy kind of love because you're just starting to feel it. That's Esmeralda. By the way, Esmeralda Leon, huge crush on DiCaprio in Romeo and Juliet. you know, was it the perfect age for her? You know what I mean?
Mm.
And the right character, the character that he played. But yeah, no, she is just, every time whenever we've mentioned like celebrity crushes, it's always Leo. Specifically from that movie, yeah. Not Titanic.
No.
Josh Holloway from Lost. My first celebrity crush was Olivia Newton-John. I liked her because of not the sexy look in Grease. He preferred the Sandra D. Bobby Sox
look.
Greta Gerwig. Leonardo DiCaprio. When I was 13 years old, I really thought I was going to marry him. I actually carried around a folder of pictures I had printed out from the internet of him. I kissed his picture every night before I went to bed. I was really sure that one day we would be together.
I was kind of hoping with Greta it would be someone like David Byrne for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, Leo was all-encompassing, man.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially after when Titanic came out, it was ridiculous.
It was the end times for girl crushes. It was just all Leo.
Jamie King. Eddie Furlong in Terminator 2.
Okay.
Because he had that long, sweet skater haircut. It's the first one I can remember being like, ooh, that guy is so cute. Whatever happened to Edward Furlong? Did anybody know whatever happened to that guy?
I can't imagine anything good.
Didn't he get loaded and release a bunch of lobsters? I don't know why I'm thinking of this story, but I think he did. I think he got loaded years ago. He got drunk and he went into like a fish place and then released a bunch of lobsters that were in tanks.
No, that definitely happened.
It did, and it was him.
Yeah, this is
long time ago,
2004. Eddie Furlong had what they call a rowdy run-in with some supermarket crustaceans.
See, I don't even, I mean, how do I even remember that? Why would I even remember? Well, such a crazy story, actually. And that was the last time I heard about Edward Furlong, when he was drunk and he was releasing crustaceans.
You know what the weirdest part of this article is?
What's that?
They list him, his headline is Pet Cemetery 2 star.
They go to Pet Cemetery 2?
Odd.
And not T2.
I think they mentioned Terminator 2 in there, but
yeah.
Pet Cemetery 2 star Edward Furlong.
That's right. Because, you know, by the way, there's a remake of Pet Cemetery coming out, which actually looks pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, they screwed up the first, because the book is great.
Sure, yeah.
I think it's the scariest. I think it's the scariest book Stephen King's ever read. You know that that Vic is so terrified of that book?
Pet Cemetery?
Vic Vaughn, our very own Vic Vaughn, is so terrified of that book that when he was reading it, he couldn't keep it in the same room with him. He had to have it in a different room. He had to place it in a different room.
Like, he would read it, and when he would stop, he would have
put it in the kitchen or put it someplace else where he wasn't, because he didn't want to be in the same room with it.
I mean, it's freaky.
It's a scary book, and they screwed up the movie. They totally screwed up the movie. I hope this one's better.
I like the old man, though.
Fred Gwynne.
Yeah.
Fred Gwynne was the king. I mean, he was, you know, Fred Gwynne rules.
Sometimes dad is better.
Yeah. You got John Lithgow playing that role in the new one.
I think that's a solid choice.
Oh, of course.
I love a good Lithgow role.
He's great. Speaking of Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Let's see. Hannah Simone, Michael Jackson, I loved him. The way he danced, the way he sang, I thought he was everything. Jeremy Scott, Cyndi Lauper. Wow, that's a cool choice.
Very inspired.
Cyndi Lauper, I loved her when I was little. She was so unique and so different, and I was obsessed with her. I thought she was so cool. Lola Kirk. Who the hell is Lola Kirk? I don't know who that is. Lola Kirk. Her first celebrity crush was John Bon Jovi. He looked like a woman, but he was also a rock star. There was something very acceptable about him.
You could describe a lot of dudes in the 80s like that.
Yeah. I saw Bon Jovi. They opened for the Scorpions one time. Booed off the stage.
Really?
Yeah. This was before Slippery When Wet and all that crap came out. It was.
Oh, okay.
He just said, "Ooh, she's a little runaway." That was the only minor hit he had.
Uh-huh.
The Scorpions fans don't want John Bon Jovi.
No.
No.
They want metal.
They want the Scorps.
Yeah.
So he got booed off the stage.
The Bad Boys of Berlin.
It was at the Rosemont Horizon. Sarah Paulson, Brian Bloom, because there's nobody more beautiful ever. Wait, was Sarah Paulson? Sarah Paulson's gay, so her first her first crush was a guy. That's interesting.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I love Sarah Paulson.
One of the tolerable parts of Bird Box for me.
Oh yeah. Kylie or Riley Keough, Zach Hansen. He was the Hansen brother with the really long hair, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting one. How about this one? Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Okay.
Gene Wilder.
Wow.
That sounds about right for Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just
sure.
The kind of personality that Jennifer Jason Leigh has.
Yeah.
It says, growing up, Gene Wilder, he made me laugh so hard, and I just thought he was the most genius, hilarious man. He was my big crush when I was little, and Young Frankenstein is a movie that I cannot wait to share with my son.
And young Gene Wilder, I mean, he's unconventionally handsome.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. So there are some celebrity, some more celebrity crushes. All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll shift gears here. I want to talk, first of all, Tom, I want to talk a little bit about your podcast. Tell everybody about it. And then we'll talk a little movies, too. All right. But right now we got a break. It's a backcourt battle as the Bulls look to polish off the Pacers in Indy. Bulls Pacers Tuesday at 6 on WGN TV Sports. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. And we would love to hear from you. We're going to be talking about classic, memorable, some of the best TV characters of all time. So think about your favorite TV characters. They could be supporting characters, leads, whatever, just very memorable, awesome TV characters. We'll do that in a little bit. 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and your favorite and most memorable TV characters. A little chat about some TV. 312-981-7200. All right, well, Tom Hush is producing this morning. It's nice working with you, man.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's been fun. So tell everybody about the podcast you have here at WGN Radio.
Yeah, so it's a podcast called No Coast Cinema. We are a podcast that focuses on filmmakers, movers, and shakers here in the city of Chicago and the Midwest in general. And, we talk a little bit about Hollywood news and how it affects the business here, but mostly we just like talking to people who love making movies, love showing movies, love being in movies, and it's a lot of fun.
This is just an amazing time for filmmaking in this city.
Oh, it's incredible.
It's ridiculous. And TV, too. I mean, and the fact that Dick Wolf, all three of those shows got renewed again. A lot of my friends are going to be in work, are going to keep getting work. You know?
Exactly. And that's really what we're all about. We want to see people succeeding, whether it's in more mainstream stuff like the Chicago Fire PD Med shows, because that employs not just actors, but, grips and PAs and everybody you can imagine. They're all pulling locally here, and it gives a chance for folks to get some money together, maybe make a feature or a short of their own and try something new. I mean, CineSpace, the place where they're shooting all this stuff, the big soundstage is expanding. They just bought more land. So really it's just on the up and up right now.
It's really crazy. It was always, I remember for years, it was like just an unbelievable treat to have somebody film a movie here, like a Hollywood movie being filmed here.
We got excited for Transformers.
Yeah. And I mean, like, way back in the day, I remember when the Blues Brothers were shot. It was shot here, and the city virtually shut down. I mean, they took over the whole city. Mayor Byrne gave them carte blanche. Just do whatever you want, wreck whatever you want. Yeah. Smash as many Chicago police cars as you want. Tear up that mall that gets driven through in that movie. It was about to close, so Mayor Byrne was like, go ahead. Just drive through it, go nuts. And so I remember when they were here, it was a big deal. The movie came out in the summer of 80, and they shot it here in 79, like in the fall of 79, they shot it here. And they made they were making the news all the time because they were out partying. I mean, John Belushi's out partying every night. And,
he's doing the thing.
Hanging out with people, with Chicago celebrities, local Chicago celebrities and stuff. And they basically, they really did. They took over this city. There's just no question about it when they shot it. But now it's just kind of commonplace that movies are being shot here.
Yeah, you'll even be walking up here and all of a sudden you'll see, filming notice.
Yeah.
Filming notice, fire PD, or even some bigger stuff.
Yeah.
They'll just take over a city block for a while. And it's great because I want to see more people getting employed. There's a lot of really talented people in the city that just need a break. They mm-hmm. just need a chance to show their stuff. And, you know, a lot of the times eventually they'll move to L.A. or go to New York or do whatever they got to do. But it's nice to know that we can be a training ground for the next generation of talent.
Did you see the that stupid movie with The Rock, Rampage?
Rampage, yeah.
It was a stupid movie. There were things about it that I kind of enjoyed.
Sure.
I loved the fact that they destroyed the hell out of downtown.
Yeah.
I mean, the Transformers did it too.
Sure.
But it was more fun. They brought down the Sears Tower in Rampage.
Yeah.
I mean, the last 20 minutes of Rampage is the total destruction of the Loop. And I found that I was giddy watching it. I was just like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
There's something weirdly fun about watching your own city get annihilated.
And annihilated, yeah. Man. I mean, like 20 minutes of just destruction.
And I remember when they were shooting it, we were still over at Tribune Tower,
yeah.
And I must have been producing something on the top level, up on the seventh floor. We look out, there's just choppers, nobody on Michigan Avenue. We're like, what's going on? They're like, oh yeah, The Rock's out there.
Yeah.
Filming this new movie about a giant ape. I was like, right. Oh man.
Yeah.
This is the greatest thing that's ever happened.
I remember when they were shooting Transformers here. I'm sure a lot of people do, but this was again when we were at Trib Tower at that time, mm-hmm. and the streets were blocked off. We couldn't get down Michigan Avenue, so we had to go downstairs, come up, and then go through security in order to get into the building because people had a difficult time getting into the building because they shot right outside on the Broadway. As you know, yeah. If you've seen the movie, they destroy they destroy everything downtown. Yeah. The Wrigley Building gets destroyed, the Trib Building, everything.
They do it all,
but. The thing was that it was blocked off, like from the south side of the bridge, all the way to I think Ontario or something. All blocked off. And so what they did was, especially right in front of where we were in the Trib Building mm-hmm. and Pioneer Court, they made it look like the whole block had been destroyed. So I walked out in the middle of the night one night just to see what it looked like. And I walked out, and there were security guards all over the place, but they let me walk around. And there were overturned cars, like life-size overturned cars, like chunks of building were out there. It literally looked like Michigan Avenue had just been annihilated.
In case you were ever curious about what the apocalypse in Chicago would look like, Nick DiGilio has
it was cool because it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I walked outside. I think it was like during a news break, or maybe it was 4 in the morning or something. I don't remember exactly. Yeah. But it was really late, and there was nobody on the street, so it looked really weird.
God.
You know, because it was like nobody was on the street. Well, first of all, the streets were closed,
mm-hmm.
so there were no traffic, nothing. I walked out in the middle of Michigan Avenue, and I looked around. There were flipped over cars, there were busted buildings, just things destroyed all over the place. The bridge had been, annihilated.
Yeah,
and those were all practical effects. Those were, you know what I mean? Like those were real flipped over cars. I'm sure they, and of course they added a ton of CGI because that's what the Transformers
sure.
movies are.
Yeah.
But it was pretty cool, 3 o'clock in the morning, walking out on the street and going, wow, this is all right. So, yeah. But that was, yeah. But I just, films that are shot here in Chicago, it's always a lot of fun, to see movies. It was like, it was fantastic to see Widows.
Oh, my God. Like, they do a couple diner scenes, and it's at this place called, the Golden House Diner. Is right next to the Riviera in Uptown,
mm-hmm.
and I live in Uptown, and I remember sitting in the theater and watching it, and you just have this moment where you're like, wait a second, this looks really familiar, seeing all the interior
yeah.
shots, and then they pull out, and you're just like, oh man, I have breakfast there every Thursday.
They use the city beautifully in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, they really did, and there was a lot of local talent. I had a couple of my good friends were in that movie. One of the ones, my buddy Steve Walker, who I've directed and acted with for many, many years, he was the reporter who was trying to ask Colin Farrell the questions outside.
Oh, that's him.
That's my buddy Steve. And I recognized his voice right away because you don't see his face at
yeah.
first. You just hear his voice. I said, man, that's Walker. That's Steve Walker. and I will say this. It's a damn shame that nobody saw that movie. Well, I mean, it bombed. It bombed.
It did. And it's strange to me because it's Oscar-winning director, an incredible cast,
yeah.
And it's set in this... I kind of hoped it would at least do well in Chicago, but, you know, no accounting for taste.
It's a great movie. It's so a terrific good. Movie. It was one of my favorites of last year. Exciting, great thriller, great heist movie, really well acted. Political stuff, too.
Even Rick Pearson is listed with a special thanks in that.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. Yeah. I mean, how else are you going to get the aldermanic sort
but they,
of tension,
but no, but
right?
they do add some really cool stuff about Chicago politics
yeah.
in the movie. But it's just beautifully shot. That's mm-hmm. Widows. This is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, I believe it's out on DVD.
Yeah, you can get it pretty much anywhere now.
So, but it's a great movie. And if you like seeing movies that are shot in Chicago, that's a really great one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a break here because the news is coming up right after this. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning, and that means my dad is going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We have a Blackhawks Express from last night's game that we are going to play back. It's not a happy one, but we're going to play it back nonetheless. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are going to be talking a little bit later on about your favorite, most memorable, best TV characters of all time. But we're talking some general movie stuff with Tom here, locally, looking at some of the local stuff that that happens in the city. We got a call here from Bill on WGN. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, Nick. This happened, I don't know, remember what year it was, probably in the late 80s, early 90s. You remember when Croc and Montana used to be on Wabash Street?
Sure.
And then they closed it, and then a Walgreens moved in there. I think it was a utility stationery store in their space.
Okay.
Well, anyways, I live way on the south side. I used to ride the, what back then called the Dan Ryan Oak Park train. It's the red line now. It used to run over top.
Right.
And every morning I'd ride. I'd get off of Madison Street, and I'd come down the stairs and go south on Wabash to Monroe and around the corner where I worked. Well, this one morning, I come down, and I walk down the stairs, and, of course, to make us a little better, I'm visually handicapped, so I'm walking down the street, and I get to Walgreens, and I turn in to pick up a prescription. And I figured, well, there's nobody on the street this morning. That's strange. There are people on the street. So I go into Walgreens, and I get my prescription, come back out, and I come out the door of Walgreens to make a left to go to Monroe Street, around the corner where I worked. And just as I step out the door, I think about three steps, and bam, this guy and I run into each other. He hits me on the side, and he goes sprawling across the sidewalk. And I caught myself, and all of a sudden, I hear some guy, cut, 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 who let him on the sidewalk? And it was no security stopped me, and of course, I couldn't see the sign. I think it was shooting a movie called, I think it was with Wesley Snipes in it. And I tripped him and sprawled him off across the sidewalk.
That was the sequel to The Fugitive.
Oh, is that what it was? I can't remember what it was.
Well, U.S. Marshals.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, right. He would come out of that store. I don't know what they were doing, what the scene was, but he come out of the store, and just as I turned to my left and stepped, we just collided right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, so I got by security. No one ever saw me, I guess, whatever it was.
That's pretty ridiculous. That's pretty ridiculous. Wow. Wow. All right. Did you
Anyways, I got to shake his hand and meet him. You know, I told him I was sorry, and he said, that's okay. You know, and he said, am I all right? You know,
cool. That's a great story, Bill. That's a great one.
Okay.
All right. All right. Take care. You know, they shot that right outside. I mean, they shot that movie everywhere, U.S. Marshals. And I used to work downtown on Institute Place, which is a very small street, but it's right by the L. The L tracks go right by.
Okay.
And we were working, and this was when I was a managing editor at a magazine called Roy Leonard's Going Out Guide, where I wrote for it, and I was the editor. It was obviously Roy Leonard magazine about entertainment. And so our offices were right there, and we were on the third floor. so we could see directly out of our window. We were pretty much on the same level as the L. And there were like a ton of people outside, crew members and everything, because they were shooting there. And there were several times when during that day that the L went by our window with Wesley Snipes on top of it. Like they were shooting they were shooting the scene with Wesley Snipes running around on top of the L and running around on the tracks and stuff, and his body double, like on top of the train. But it was pretty cool because we could see it right from our window. We didn't, there were a lot of people on the street, really couldn't see it, but we had a bird's eye view.
Just checking out Wesley Snipes
pulling
the moves from U.S. Marshals and Money Train. And
U.S. Marshals. And that thing bombed.
Out
too.
That was unfortunate.
Yeah. I didn't think it was a bad movie.
It was all right.
It was okay. I mean, it wasn't nearly as good as The Fugitive, but it was okay. Like local movies. What's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie ever?
Yeah.
It's a little bit of an obvious choice, but Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That was one that I saw just at the right place at the right time. I was probably about 14, and I'd been introduced to Quentin Tarantino I saw Death Proof, and I was like, oh, wow, this is weird.
Wait, that was the first movie first Quentin Tarantino movie you saw was Death Proof?
Yeah.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. And it holds a very special place in my heart.
Oh, that's great.
It's a wild movie. Kurt Russell, absolutely.
He's the king.
Oh, he's the king in the movie. Yeah. Stuntman Mike.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, I got to figure out.
I can't believe that was your first Tarantino movie.
We were watching it. I think it was me and a buddy. We were in high school, probably freshman in high school.
Now, had you watched Planet Terror, too? Or
no, because at that point, I knew that the Grindhouse movies were out there.
Yeah.
Because they had come out in like 2007, 2008. And but my parents would not let me go to a theater to see a rated R movie.
Yeah.
So one night I was spending the night at my buddy's house, and Comcast On Demand was like the greatest invention of all time. So we're skipping through. We're like, all right, what's on like Showtime? What's on Cinemax? And Death Proof shows up, and I'm like, oh, it's got this. It's made by that Quentin Tarantino guy.
Now, so the version that you're watching was the director's cut.
Yeah.
The longer version, like the 2-hour version.
Right.
Yeah, which is better.
Completely separate from Planet Terror. But I missed out on the fun, like the fake trailers that they did, like Machete and
Don't was the best one.
Wasn't that Edgar Wright? Such a funny thing.
It was hilarious.
Oh, so good. But yeah, I watched Death Proof and I was like, this is a really weird movie because basically nothing happens really for about 20 to 30 minutes.
Oh yeah, it's nothing but talking.
And
it's just girls talking.
Yeah.
The opening is a pretty spectacular opening, but outside of that,
and I was beguiled. I was like, you can make movies like this. This is crazy. So, and then I went on to watch Pulp Fiction, and that was just it for me. I was like, this guy is he's my idol, and that's what got me into movies more than just, oh wow, I really like watching movies, they're entertaining. This was like, I need to know how this was made, who made it, who's in it, everything involved.
Yeah. I can see that. I can see that at the right age. I mean, obviously the first Tarantino movie I saw was Reservoir Dogs. And it was a major, one of the best film directorial debuts of all time. And just like a major voice. Just, it was so distinctive. And I remember, because nobody knew who Quentin Tarantino was at that time. I saw it in like the fall or early fall of 92 when it first came out. And I remember going, whoa, and the movie got made because of Harvey Keitel.
Mm-hmm.
He put up the money and he put up a lot of money for it and got it, and got it made. And I just remember thinking just the storytelling was so unique and, the time structure going back and forth in time, which is of course, Tarantino's sort of trademark at this point. That was a movie that made a huge impact on me. My favorite Tarantino movie, and I know a lot of people, Pulp Fiction is my favorite Tarantino movie, and I know that that's like, it's, cliched to say, but I think it's the best movie he's ever made. I still think it's the best movie he's ever made. He's made a lot of great movies.
Yeah, it's his most realized vision in a lot of ways, and he's done a lot of stuff that are a particular vision, like Kill Bill is as an homage to Japanese, and Hong Kong kind of like action cinema.
Yeah, well, I mean, the second one is a Western. The second one is Leone. I mean,
yeah, he moves on.
Yeah,
but as an action picture, either one or the other feels realized in its own way. Even Jackie Brown as his homage to blaxploitation. And I mean, he went for it. He brought in Pam Grier.
That's a monumentally underrated movie.
Totally.
When people mention Tarantino movies, they very rarely mention Jackie Brown, and Jackie Brown is a great movie.
Yeah.
And not just, I mean, Robert Forster was great in it, but, I mean, everybody was phenomenal in that movie. The cast was so good.
I mean, Chris Tucker's in it for, what, 2 minutes?
Yeah.
I'm
high.
He just chews scenery, and it's so good.
It's like, he throws him in the trunk. And then Strawberry Letter 23 by the Brothers Johnson is playing. He just drives like 15 feet. Said, oh, that movie is great. I love Inglourious Basterds. I think Inglourious Basterds is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think Brad Pitt is hilarious in it. And I just love how blatantly it just, you know, changes history.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a great one. He's made a lot of great movies. I'm looking forward to the Charlie Manson movie.
Yeah, I'm interested. I'm a little nervous because I feel like with Django and Hateful Eight, I liked them. I liked them very much, and I think they're still in his style. But with the passing of his amazing, superbly talented editor, Sally Menke, things are starting to get a little off the rails. Yeah. And hopefully he can tighten it up and find that really tight voice again.
I got to say, I had a good amount of issues with Django. I had probably was way too long. But I got to say this, I loved Hateful Eight. I adored that movie. It was one of my favorite movie going experiences that year. I saw it the day after Christmas. The year it opened, I saw it the day after Christmas of 2016, I think, when that movie opened.
Yeah.
And I saw it at the Music Box in 75mm, or in 70mm, with the intermission.
The roadshow program.
It was one of the best experiences, you know. I saw it, like, it was at, like, 11 a.m. I went on Christmas, you know, December 26th in the morning. Mm-hmm. Packed house. Everybody loved it. And I just, I love that movie. I think Hateful Eight is great.
I think it'll grow as time goes on. People will look back on it and say, wow, this was a really interesting take for him and a really interesting movie. And what a way to make going to the movies an event.
Oh, no, again, absolutely. There's another thing I loved about it. But the other thing is that it was so, you know, blatantly influenced by John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
I mean, just even the casting of Kurt Russell. But, I mean, just like these guys are all trapped. There's a snowstorm outside. Somebody's not who they think they are. You know what I mean? I was like, okay, you enjoy The Thing. And he also used the Morricone score from The Thing. There's a scene in the movie. Well, the scene where Kurt Russell is, like, coughing up blood and everything.
Yeah.
That score, the piece of music, is a piece of music that Morricone composed for Carpenter's The Thing, and they didn't use it. But they use it on one of the menus on the DVD. So that, like, if you don't pick the, you know, what you want to watch, scene selection, coming attractions, whatever, this piece of music comes on, and so I recognized it right away because there had been times in my drinking days, there had been times when I would come home drunk and immediately put on The Thing because that was one of my go to. You know, I'd come home hammered and I'd be like, clearly I have to watch The Thing for the 5,000th time.
It's time.
So, I remember there had been times when I would put The Thing on, I'd put the DVD on, and then I'd pass out on the couch and I'd wake up to that music because that we would be playing on the menu. And so,
just burned into your skull.
And as soon as it started in Hateful Eight, as soon as the theme started, I was like, oh my God!
They did it!
That's a deep cut, Mr. Tarantino.
Oh, jeez.
All right. We got to take a break here, and we got some weather, and it sucks. That's pretty much all you need to know. For today, a wind chill advisory is in effect through mid-morning. Temperatures from 5 below well inland to 2 above downtown. For tomorrow, cloudy, very cold, struggles to reach 20 degrees. For Wednesday, sunshine, highs in the middle 20s. For Thursday, cloudy, chance of snow by the afternoon, especially south of the city with temperatures creeping towards 30. And then for Friday, mostly sunny afternoon, temperatures break freezing for the first time in nearly a week. We have that to look forward to. Currently at O'Hare, it's 2 below, Midway at 0, Lakefront 3 degrees. By the way, I just want to let everybody know it's March 4th, just to remind you that we're having this weather in March. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back after this on 720 WGN. Yeah, this is it, man.
That's a terrifying piece of music.
It's a great piece of music. I was kind of shocked that Carpenter ended up not using it in the movie, in the final cut of the thing. Anyway, that's a piece of music by Ennio Morricone that was used in Hateful Eight, but was also used on one of the menu on one of the menus for the DVD of the thing. So, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, and we're here until 5 o'clock. After the news, we're going to talk about some of our favorite and most memorable TV characters. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Who are some of your favorite and most memorable TV characters? They have a lot of fun talking about that. 312-981-7200. We've been talking a little bit movies here with Tom. And so I can understand that, you know, everybody, I think everybody has a movie like you with Pulp Fiction. There is that one movie that just like, that's it. You know, you go from, you know, casual movie fan to sort of obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was John Carpenter's Halloween. When I saw Halloween, and I had seen a ton of movies at that point. I mean, I've been a movie freak basically since birth. And my father would take me down to the Loop when they used to have, like, 20 theaters down there, big, beautiful theaters. Well, they were kind of grindhousey by that point. They were not in great shape. You know, there were some rat issues and stuff, but they were still big, giant movie theaters. Mm-hmm. So that was my childhood experience of going to movies, was going down to the Loop, to the grindhouses, and seeing these movies. And you know, this is like starting in the late 60s, early 70s. So by the time Halloween came out, 1978, I had been to like hundreds of movies already, you know. And again, horror movies are, that's my favorite genre. Grew up, you know, loving the old Universal movies on creature features, Dracula, Frankenstein, and then the Hammer movies, the British Hammer movies with Peter Cushing, who's my hero. So I had already had a taste for horror movies. And the thing about Halloween was that it was the movie where I had a sense finally of what a director did, because I didn't know. I would see credits and stuff, and I knew that there was a, you know, somebody directed the movie, but I didn't know really until I saw Halloween. And when I saw Halloween, I was like, okay, I understand now. I think I understand what a director does. And I remember after seeing the movie, went outside where the posters were. Because remember, movie theaters used to have outdoor, you know, they'd have marquees and posters and lobby displays and stuff. They didn't have that anymore. But anyway, and I looked for the director's name. And it was like, okay, I'll remember this name. It's John Carpenter. His name is John Carpenter. And then I went back and saw Assault on Precinct 13 and Dark Star and became obsessed with Carpenter. He's my favorite director. And that was the movie. That was the life-changing movie for me, was Halloween. And I just vividly remember when it was over going, oh, wow.
And he's really one of not just horror cinema, but just cinema's great stylists, in a sense where you know you're watching a Carpenter flick.
Absolutely.
You just know there's something about what he's doing
that
is so distinct. And
nobody frames in scope like John Carpenter.
Yeah.
And, you know, his frequent collaborator at that time was Dean Cundey, who one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. Gary Kibb shot a bunch of his movies. And then he was off for a long time. He didn't make a movie for a really long time. And then he made a movie called The Ward. And it was 10 years. I think it was 10 years between movies, because I think Ghost of Mars was the last movie that he had made. And then 10 years later, he made The Ward. And I remember watching The Ward, because it didn't really get a theatrical release.
No.
Which sucks, you know, because he's John Carpenter, and any John Carpenter movie should get a good theatrical release. But anyway.
Absolutely, yeah.
I remember, you know, watching it very excited because, you know, he's my favorite director and he hadn't made a movie in a really long time. And I was like, okay, it's been a long time, you know, and this thing is, you know, kind of getting, you know, like it's gone straight to video and it's not getting the kind of, within 5 minutes, like you said, I was like, okay, it's John Carpenter, you know, cause it was just the way it was shot, the style, the use of the camera, the, you know, the shooting in scope, The movements, everything about it, his cutting, it's so distinctive that it was like, okay, he's still got it. He's still John Carpenter. And The Ward is a really good movie.
Yeah, it's one that I've been meaning to go and check out, but I need to get into later Carpenter, like post The Thing, like, or is Prince of Darkness in
87.
That? Yeah.
Great
and,
movie.
In the Mouth of Madness.
Great movie.
With Sam Neill. I've always wanted to check that out.
I'm actually quoted on the video of that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Have you seen Big Trouble in Little China?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, big, I was going to say
Trouble. That was one that it took me despite being so distinctly him, I was like, wow, I can't believe that this is a Carpenter movie because it's kind of funny, like
it's
really
hilarious.
Funny.
The thing about Carpenter's movies, and I've mentioned this before, is that he's made several movies that when they were released bombed. Okay, The Thing. When The Thing came out in the summer of 1982, it tanked and it got terrible reviews. And now people are like, oh, yeah, it's a classic. It's one of the greatest horror science fiction movies ever made. Well, where the hell were you in 1982?
They were too busy watching E.T.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And that Big Trouble in Little China bombed. It almost ended his career. Total bomb. And now classic. That's just it's so weird how that happens with Carpenter's movies.
Yeah, he was always a forward thinker in a lot of ways. I mean, he helped birth the modern slasher.
Yeah,
I mean him and Tobe Hooper really.
Yeah,
And then you throw in Hitchcock for Psycho. But speaking of Hitchcock, he's a purveyor of what Hitchcock called pure cinema.
Oh yeah,
the guy believed in the power of the camera.
You know what's amazing is I've had the immense pleasure of meeting Carpenter and interviewing him twice and doing his Q&A at the Flashback Horror Convention, and it's one of my favorite things that I've ever gotten to do. And the filmmaker that he's most obsessed with is Howard Hawks.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, I blatantly asked him one time, I was like, you know, during one of our interviews, I go, exactly how many times are you going to remake Rio Bravo? I just want to know. And he laughed. He's like, yeah. I said, well, what is it about the themes of Rio Bravo? People trapped inside and there's evil on the outside. It's, uh-huh. You know, Assault on Precinct 13 is like that. Prince of Darkness is like that. I mean, so many, there's the thing. And he just talked about how, you know, when he was a kid, Howard Hawks was his favorite filmmaker. And Rio Bravo was a big influence on him, clearly. Because
yeah.
He's, like I said,
how
many times are you going to remake Rio Bravo? Yeah. And I'm glad he had a good sense of humor about it. He could have punched me right in the face.
Sure.
But he did have a good sense of humor about it. So anyway. Yeah, so those are the influential movies, you know. It's amazing how they stay with you. And then you immediately, like, you went, after you saw Pulp Fiction, you went nuts and went back on the Tarantino.
I started dressing like Jean-Luc Godard. Like, I was just like, all right, I need to go get Band of Outsiders. I need Breathless.
Right.
I need Weekend. I need to understand what he's doing.
Yep. It's fun when that happens, really is, and it happens to you know, a lot of people who love movies. It's a great experience to have that happen. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back after the news, we are going to jump into your favorite and most memorable TV characters of all time. Those will be fun. 312-981-7200. But we'll do that right after the news, which is next. All right, welcome back, everybody. How's it going? Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And that's a Monday morning. And we also have a Blackhawks Express to play from last night's game. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And right now, we're going to talk about your favorite or most memorable TV characters of all time. 312-981-7200. They did like a poll and had a whole bunch of different people on this website pick their most memorable TV characters. There's some interesting choices here. Tom, anything pop into your head?
Well, I'm going to say at least in the top five is Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
That's the most obvious choice to me.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Of course, it's played by Carol O'Connor. You know, the characters, you know, like... Actually, like all of the characters on All in the Family.
Meathead.
Yeah. I mean, Edith is one of my favorite characters of all time.
Yeah.
But Archie Bunker is a big one. I immediately went to one of my favorite characters in TV history is George Costanza. I mean, he's my favorite character on Seinfeld. I think Jason Alexander is fantastic. And I just love all the characters on that show are reasonably despicable, Like, the four leads on Seinfeld are not the most likable people in the world. They're incredibly selfish and, you know, and I think it's appropriate, even though I hated the finale, I think it's appropriate that they end up in jail. That's, like, where those four people should be. But the stuff that goes on with George Costanza, just the character that is such a great character, and it's, I love that it's based on Larry David. The whole Costanza family, and just his dad and
Serenity
his
Now.
Oh my God! I mean, my favorite episode of Seinfeld, and I've said this before on the air, but I was late to the game on Seinfeld. I did not watch it in the 90s when it was on. Did not watch it at all.
Caught those reruns,
but I started watching it like 99, 2000. And I've now seen every episode about 50,000 times, and I know them all by heart. But my favorite episode is, it's a Costanza, fueled episode. And it's called The Opposite. It's the one where George Costanza decides that he's going to do the opposite of every instinct that he does because everything is so wrong. So he does the opposite of what his instincts tells him to do. And that's where his life goes back up. He gets the job with the Yankees. He gets to the apartment. He's got a girlfriend. And then that's when Julia Louis-Dreyfus, she goes down. So she like becomes George. And then in the other section is that the other part of the show is that's where Jerry Seinfeld is even Steven, where everything evens out. Like Elaine throws a 20 out the window, the $20 bill out the window. And she goes, let's see if we get the 20 back. He goes, you could have thrown a pencil out the window and had the same result. And then George comes up, opens up the door, and goes, look what I just found, a 20. And so he found the 20, but then Jerry finds a 20 in his old, he pulled out a jacket that he hadn't worn in a while, and he found a 20. So he's even Steven. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, his life is going down the toilet. But George Costanza is doing great because he's doing the opposite. And that's the one that's also the subplot with Kramer. That's the coffee table book episode where he goes on Regis and Kathy Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, all of that is in one episode. All of that stuff is in one episode. It's the best. But yeah, when I hear favorite TV characters, Costanza's way up there on my list. The first one that they polled here, and somebody picked Phoebe from Friends.
You know, I have never been a Friends person.
Yeah, me neither.
I can't get on board with it, and I find Phoebe especially to be super annoying.
I don't watch the show.
Yeah,
you know, but I like Lisa Kudrow a lot.
She's great. Yeah, no disrespect on her.
But. Anyone who watched Friends knows that Phoebe is a unique character. She's quirky, sometimes superstitious. Had an interesting life before she met her core group of besties, and is the genius behind the iconic Smelly Cat song. Aside from penning Smelly Cat, Phoebe is also the character who said the now famous line in theory that Ross and Rachel are being each other's lobsters. She supports her friends and was a surrogate for her brother and his wife, proving that she had a big heart. Okay. They didn't mention her twin.
Yeah,
she's got a twin on that show.
She also got to, didn't she marry Paul Rudd in the show?
Or
they were together or something.
They dated. Well, yeah. Sean Penn dated her on the show.
Yeah.
There was a lot of superstars on that show.
That was huge.
At one point, you know, the celebrities who would pop up on that show, it was pretty amazing. But another one picks Carlton Banks from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Do the Carlton? Wasn't that the name of his...
Yeah, the Carlton. When he dances to It's Not Unusual,
it's not unusual.
By Tom Jones.
Right. Next, someone picks, a contributor picks Lucy Ricardo from I Love Lucy. That's a classic.
Sure.
Legendary. Legendary. Let's see. Here's Paulette on WGN. Hi, Paulette.
Hi. How you doing?
All right.
Well, my favorite character, or one of them, is Barney Fife.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I have a trivia question for you. I was wondering if you might know the answer to this. Do you remember the episodes where Barney would get in trouble with his landlady? One of them, he was cooking in his room. Do you remember his landlady? Do you know the actress who played her?
No.
Her name is Enid Markey, and she is the first Jane in the Tarzan movies.
Oh, okay.
In the silent movies.
Okay. No, I didn't know that. I didn't really watch Andy Griffith with much regularity.
Well, see, I'm a little older than you, so when I was growing up, that was a big thing on TV.
Oh no, it was a big thing on TV when I was growing up too. I mean, in reruns, it was on all the time.
Yeah.
But I just never. I think Don Knotts is great, and when I do watch the show, I love Barney Fife. I think he's hilarious, and I think if I'm not mistaken, I think he won 4 Emmys or something for.
I think he did.
Yeah.
I think he did, but he would be, without him, the show just would not have been the same.
No, I agree. I totally agree. I totally agree. And the byplay between him and Andy Griffith was great.
Oh, yeah.
They had great chemistry together. All right, Paulette, thank you. Have a great morning.
If you ever get to look it up, Enid Markey was a beautiful young woman.
Okay.
Gorgeous.
Okay.
Okay,
All right, Paulette, good night. Take care. Here's Philip on WGN. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
Yeah, my favorite actress was Angela Cartwright from Lost in Space.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was now we can go back to crushes there. Like we were talking,
you
were talking a little bit about that earlier on. We were talking about celebrity crushes. That's one. That's definitely one, without question. So, all right, thanks, Philip.
Thank you. Bye bye.
All right, take care. All right, another contributor says Mary Richards from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. There's a lot of characters on that show that could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could be listed as great characters. How about this one? This one I totally agree with. Michael Scott from The Office.
Yeah, and I think he outdoes Ricky Gervais from the original British version.
Well, I love the British version.
Sure.
I love it.
And it's apples and oranges in a lot
of
ways.
And I remember, when they first said that they were going to do an American version, I was like, no, because I loved the Ricky Gervais version. Loved it. And I was like, no. And then when I watched the premiere of the American version, it was almost identical to the first episode of the British version.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, come on, man. Then they started to vary it. And then eventually, obviously, it became its own thing, and it's great.
Yeah. They found a sort of American earnestness
that
they injected into the show where you wouldn't even know that they were the same show at any point.
But it started off rocky, though. It started off
that
pretty
first
rocky.
Season was not great, although I will say Diversity Day is one of the sharper episodes they ever wrote.
It's, there are so many great episodes, and the characters are so memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, maintain, and I guess I agree with them, that the show outstayed its welcome, but when...
Yeah, nine
seasons,
yeah.
and Steve Carell had left, he was gone for 2 seasons or something like that.
Yeah.
Ed Helms came in and became the boss, there's still great moments in it because the rest of the cast is so good. But Michael Scott, certainly one of the more memorable characters.
Agreed.
Marsha Brady in The Brady Bunch, everybody's favorite Brady girl.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Don Draper, Mad Men.
That show, is that in the conversation for best TV shows of all time?
It should be.
It's certainly Don Draper in for character, because I don't know if I ever paid that much attention to TV until we got into, Lost and Mad Men. Lost was event television.
The thing about Mad Men, you have to go back at that time. AMC wasn't doing original programming.
No.
Like, they didn't have Walking Dead. They didn't have any of the other shows.
They showed movies.
Yeah. And so it was weird. They're like, what is this TV show? What is this thing? And nobody in the cast was well known. Nobody knew who Jon Hamm was, and so it was this weird thing. And it took a long time to take off Mad Men. And to this day, there are people who are kind of just discovering it. But you go back historically, that's one of the best shows. I mean, it's an unbelievable TV show.
Even that pilot.
Yeah.
It's just...
No, it's great.
Knocks it out of the park.
Incredible cast, and Jon Hamm is great. And then, the other lovely discovery about Jon Hamm is only really knowing his work, for Mad Men, just to find out how funny he is. Because he's hilarious. And the first time he hosted SNL was revelatory. I just remember thinking, okay, let's see this Don Draper guy. I don't know how funny he's going to be, and he was unbelievable.
Was that Jon Hamm's Jon Hamm?
Yeah, well, John, there was John. Yeah, there was the one where he was Michael Bublé was
Hammond Bublé.
Yeah, where he's got like Michael Bublé kidnapped or something. Yeah, that's forcing him to do the commercial in the restaurant. And then one of the other things was he did a fantastic. Bill Hader did one of his incredible Vincent Price impersonations on the Vincent Price Halloween special. And John Hamm and Kristen Wiig show up, and Kristen Wiig is doing Gloria Swanson, and John Hamm is doing James Mason. And his James Mason is amazing. And the incredible thing about it was he was supposed to be Sinatra, and at the last minute they changed it and said, "Can you do a James Mason?" He went, "I guess." And his James Mason is on the money. "I say, Price, where are the whores?" Oh, man. All right, we got a break. We're talking about your favorite TV characters of all time, most memorable. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Today, the wind chill advisory is in effect through the mid-morning. Temperatures from 5 below well inland to about 2 above downtown. Tomorrow, cloudy, very cold. Highs struggle to reach 20 degrees. Wednesday, sunshine. Highs reach the middle 20s. Thursday, cloudy, chance of snow by the afternoon, especially south of the city, and the temperatures creep toward 30. And then finally, mostly sunny on afternoon on Friday. Temperatures will finally break freezing for the first time in nearly a week. It's currently 2 below at O'Hare, it's 0 at Midway, and it's 3 degrees at the lakefront. All right, we'll take a quick break here. When we come back, more memorable TV characters from you and us, 312-981-7200. It's a backcourt battle as the Bulls look to polish off the Pacers in Indy. Bulls, Pacers, Tuesday at 6 on WGN TV Sports. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago. Here until 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. We have a Blackhawks Express, another unfortunate Blackhawks Express that we'll be playing back a little bit later on. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're currently talking about your favorite or most memorable TV characters of all time. Talk and text, 312-981-7200. Who are some of your favorites, most memorable TV characters of all time? And they had a whole bunch of people contribute to their choices on this website called Insider, where they picked their favorite or their most memorable TV characters. And so we're taking a look at that and talking about yours, too. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's see. 11 from Stranger Things. Someone chose her. It's rare for a debut season of a show to produce an instant new cultural phenomenon, but Stranger Things did just that with its heroine, 11. The superpowered, shaved-head young girl spurred a spike of sales in blonde wigs, pink dresses, and boxes of Eggos, and she was just getting started. Only mouth breathers wouldn't think to include 11 on the ranking of the most iconically memorable TV characters of all time. Yeah, that Millie Bobby Brown is something, man. She's pretty great. And I remember... they told the story about how she was really nervous to to shave her head. Like she didn't really want to do it. She was freaking out, and so the producers, the Duffer Brothers, the guys who created Stranger Things, you know, they were trying to reassure her that it was going to be cool and that it was okay, and you know, she'll look fine, she'll shave her head and she'll look fine. But Millie Bobby Brown was really nervous about it, and then the Duffer Brothers showed her Mad Max Fury Road, and then she went, "Oh, oh, it's Furiosa. I get what you're trying to do here. All right, I'll shave my head." So, by the way, that is one movie, Mad Max Fury Road, that is way high up on my list of movies that I've seen way too many times. I've seen Fury Road. I can't tell you how many times I've seen Fury Road. I saw it 3 times in 2 days the week it opened. The weekend it opened, I saw it 3 times in 2 days. Yeah, I kind of like it.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the greatest movies ever made.
It's definitely
the it set a new standard for an action picture.
I mean, I've you know,
from one of the masters.
I mean, you know, it's for me, it's the third best movie ever. It's my third favorite movie of all time. My favorite movie of all time is Magnolia.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That is an interesting choice. I like it.
My second favorite is Risky Business.
Okay.
Because I was 18 when it came out, and I was between high school and college. Now, I wasn't, you know, I'm not a rich kid from Glencoe.
No.
but the stuff that Joel Goodson was dealing with was universal.
Sure, yeah.
Especially at the age of 18. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, it's a great film. It's just a great, great
movie.
It's
a lot of fun.
Net shot here.
Yeah.
And then Fury Road is third.
Wow. Fury
Road, man. I'm telling you, the first time I saw it, my mind was... And I'm a huge Mad Max series of the fan. I back Thunderdome.
Thunderdome gets a bad rap.
It does.
It's a lot of... I'm here for Thunderdome.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people bitch about the kids. And I can understand that the kids are annoying. The whole section with the kids is a bit much. And I can totally understand that. But there are action sequences in Thunderdome that are as good as any in any movie.
And plus Tina Turner.
Tina Turner.
She kills it.
Come on, man. Welcome to Thunderdome. Here's Ron on WGN. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, Nick. Nick, do you remember the TV series Yancey Derringer?
I do not.
Jack Mahoney was the gambler, and he had an Indian sidekick named Pahu, and his name on the credits was X Brands.
Like his real name?
That's what the credits said, and he was on a TV series with Cheyenne and some other TV series where he played especially Indian characters, but his name was X, the letter X, and then Brands, which went along. I think it was a play on at that time, commercials you would have, you do not want Brand X, you want Tide.
Right, right.
But if you look up the credits, Yancey Derringer and his sidekick, his name was X Brands.
That's crazy.
But one more thing. You know, a friend of mine was at the Y. He was telling me, you ever watched the old Andy Griffin? You know, of course, we all watched Andy Griffin. He was watching Andy Griffin, and Andy and Barney were out driving at night, and some farmer was plowing. And Andy or Barney said, what do you think he's planting? And they said marijuana back in the 60s. And then I thought, that was a CBS series, and they also had the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah.
And at that time, you had Puff the Magic Dragon. So I could see the tie-in, okay? But another trivia point.
Wow. All right. Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome, Nick.
Take care. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here's Bill on WGN. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, Nick. I'm going to go way back. You probably remember Mike Connors and Mannix. But
sure.
Before that, he played a show in the early 50s. It was called Tightrope. He was like an undercover guy. And it was preceded, and of course you got the Honeymooners. Now the guy you just had on, I was talking about the marijuana, the Andy Griffith show.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in Indiana, and the area I grew up in, they grew marijuana back during the Second World War for hemp because they made rope out of
right,
it.
Right, right.
And we lived on a farm, and we used to cut that stuff down because we used to shore our electric fences out. And I can take you to a spot right now. We had 20 acres of woods. And if the government hasn't stepped in and done it, there's at least an acre of marijuana growing back there wild every year.
Wow.
I could have been a rich man, but I knew anything about the stuff back then. Didn't even bother anything about it.
Wow. Wow. All right.
It just grew wild. It was a regular weed. You know, we just, because they planted in that area to grow it for the military back in World
right.
War II and that.
Right.
But no.
All right. Okay. All right, Bill. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. If you're looking for some pot, go to Indiana. All right. Another person contributed, Jack McFarlane from Will and Grace. What's the Megan Mullally's character's name on it? Karen.
Mm-hmm.
See, you know, the show should have been called Jack and Karen because they were the more memorable characters. Oh, man. My future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo, played Karen's mom on an episode this past season.
Because is this the second season of their revival?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really hugely popular.
Yeah, they're firing in all cylinders.
Yeah. That was a show that I just casually got into. I mean, I think everybody in it is really talented. All right, how about Willow Rosenberg from Buffy?
You know, is that...
That's Allison Hannigan.
Yeah. I mean, and I was not huge into Buffy.
Yeah.
I wasn't a big Buffy kid, but she was one of the few people that I actually remembered.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah.
I like Allison Hannigan. Always
she's
have.
She's got a charm.
She's great. She's great in American Pie. Great. All right, we got a break here. We got the news coming up right after this, and then more memorable TV characters. 312-981-7200.
It's your first check-in with the business day ahead.
What does it take to run a 120-year-old nonprofit? We'll meet the new president of Chicago's Anti-Cruelty Society, Tracy Elliott, and have a conversation about the business of protecting and caring for animals at 508.
The opening bell with Steve Gazanich next on 720 WGN.
Tune in later this morning for Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder. That's coming up here on WGN, 4:30 right now. Let's get to the newsroom and Vic Vaughn.
Thank you, Nick. Sub-zero wind chill factors this morning as many begin their morning commute. Prepare for daybreak temps near zero. Wind chills as low as 25 below in some areas. Your forecast coming up. An off-duty Chicago police officer was killed in a crash early this morning on the Eisenhower. It happened around 1 a.m. near Kedzie. Illinois State Police are investigating. Metro's new reverse commuter pilot program begins today. It's for those who live in Chicago and work in Lake County. Beginning today, Metro's adding express trains and reverse commute trains each morning and evening. The program's slated to last at least 2 years. Academy Award-winning actor Kevin Spacey's groping case heads to court today on Nantucket Island. His attorneys will take part in a pretrial hearing. Spacey's accused of groping an 18-year-old man in 2016 at a bar on the island. In January, Spacey pleaded not guilty to felony indecent assault and battery. As for today, he's not required to attend the hearing. He is required to make himself available by phone. We'll check sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
They put in a brand new skylight in our bathroom upstairs. This was a replacement. Did a fabulous job on it. You know, we realized it wasn't the biggest job in the world, but in the same token, they treated us like it was. They didn't put us off. I can't say enough about them.
We are talking today with mega customer Jan Hoffer.
The last time they were here, they were plugging up woodpecker holes. The nice thing about these guys is that they will take on some small jobs. I mean, we don't have anything big right now, but they're always very courteous and caring. And when they do the job, they do a great job. And they're, you know, no job is, I don't think, is too small for them in terms of, you know, just taking care of their clients. We'd recommend them anytime to anybody.
One mega call does it all.
847-658-8989. 847-658-8989.
MegaPros.com.
One mega call does it all.
WGN Sports. Sharks scored three times in the third period in their 5-2 win over the Hawks. The Hawks dropped two out of three on the road trip. They're at 63 points, now 8 points back from a wild card spot with 16 games left. Hawks host Buffalo Thursday. Cubs beat the White Sox 13-4 in spring training baseball. Sox play L.A. this afternoon. You can listen to two with Ed Farmer and Darren Jackson on 720 WGN. Cubs play Cincinnati next. Big Ten basketball here on 720 last night. Illinois won at home. They beat the Wildcats 81-76. WGN traffic says still have this issue on the inbound side of the Eisenhower due to an earlier accident. The right three lanes are blocked, and that is causing some stop-and-go traffic between Costner and Pulaski, again on the inbound side of the Eisenhower. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic Chicago app. It's approved by the mortgage experts of Team Hochberg. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. The forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center, mostly sunny today, but will be starting right around zero at daybreak with morning wind chills of 15 to 25 below. A wind chill advisory expires at 9 a.m. High of just 12 degrees this afternoon. Tonight, clouds move in. Chance of light snow. A low of 6 overnight. Then Tuesday, cloudy. Chance of morning snow showers. Afternoon highs near 20. Right now, fair skies 2 below at O'Hare, 2 above at Chicago's lakefront. I'm Vic Vaughn in the WGN Radio Newsroom, and these are the stories that matter on 720 WGN.
Just chose to bump back with the greatest rock and roll song ever recorded.
I had no idea.
That's the best. That's for it's my favorite rock and roll song of all time.
It's my first concert was Cheap Trick.
Oh, I've seen him. Where'd you see him?
I saw him at the in Tinley Park at the big amphitheater.
Oh,
it was Cheap Trick, Heart, and then Journey, but sans
Steve Perry.
Steve Perry. It was the guy that they found in Southeast Asia.
Right. His name was Steve.
His name was also Steve?
Oh, yeah. They've had two singers take over for Steve Perry, both of them named Steve. I guess one of the prerequisites, if you're going to be the lead singer of Journey, you have to have the name Steve. I saw Cheap Trick. I've seen Cheap Trick. I can't tell you. I don't know how many times. It's like triple digits, maybe.
They're the pride of Rockford, man.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They're as good today as they were in 1977.
I believe it.
I mean, they're one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time. And Robin Zander, one of the best rock voices ever.
Mm-hmm.
So, good morning, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and we're here till 5 o'clock, and we're talking about most memorable TV characters. And a lot of people have chosen, there were a lot of people who participated in this on Insider, the website Insider, different people picking their favorites, and someone chose the Fonz.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to.
It was funny because that, again, is one of those deals where the character took off so much that they added him more. And then at one point it became about Fonzie, like the show was all around Fonzie. But at the beginning, he was only supposed to be in like one or two scenes. And at one point they didn't even think he was going to be a regular on the show. So, but yeah, I mean that's a classic character. There's no question about it.
If you talk to anyone my age, I'm 25. It's like, oh, what's Happy Days? Oh yeah, it's the Fonzie. It's the Fonzie.
Fonzie,
show.
Right? Yeah. Paris Geller, if we were speaking of Gilmore Girls, Paris Geller, she's one of my favorite characters of all time. I love her.
For the uninitiated, is that the mom or the daughter or neither?
That's neither.
Neither.
It's one of the daughter's classmates.
Okay.
Rory and Lorelai are the daughter and mother.
Okay.
Someone chooses Tony Soprano from The Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's a good choice. Now, I would have to choose, if we're jumping into the HBO world, one of the greatest TV characters in the history of TV, Omar Little from The Wire.
Oh, jeez. I think he probably outranks Tony Soprano, honestly.
Oh, yeah. No. I would, yeah. I mean,
Michael K. Williams.
He's unbelievable.
Ugh.
I mean, that show, we've talked about this. I've mentioned this before. The Wire's the best TV show of all time, as far as I'm concerned. It's the greatest television show that's ever been made. And, I remember watching that show, weekly, just losing my mind over the quality of it and how great the characters were and how rich it was. And I had David Simon on my show three times, got to talk to him, and he is just amazing and he's a genius. But yeah, The Wire, it's the best. And Omar, if I had to pick, I mean, there's a lot of great characters on the Wire. Like, there are a ton of great characters on The Wire.
It's like an embarrassment of riches.
It is, in every way.
Mm.
But Omar, you gotta have Omar at the top, man. I'll never forget the episode where he gets killed. Oh, my God, that little jerk.
Oh, my God. And to anybody who's upset that he said that, that show went off the air, what?
2008.
Yeah.
So we're 11 years in.
Yeah, 11 years in. Yeah. Come on now.
So I'll tell you what, my ex-wife and I, we used to watch the show together and big time. And Omar was her favorite. I mean, like many people, Omar was her favorite character on that show, like by far. And I had come home from work on a Sunday night. So it was about, I got home like, I think when I worked till 2 a.m. on Sundays. I used to work 11 to 2 before Steve and Johnny show. So I'd get home, 2:30, 2:40 on Sunday night / Monday morning. And my wife, who had to work on Monday morning, she was in bed. She'd be in bed asleep. So I'd close the bedroom door and then I'd watch a little TV. So we DVR'd the Wire every week. So I got home. We used to watch it. We watched it together, but I was like, I'm going to watch by myself here. So I watched the episode of The Wire, and it's the episode where Omar gets killed. And it comes out of nowhere. And it happens. It's not the end of the episode. It happens about 20 minutes into the episode. There's still about 40 minutes left. And it's just so, it just comes out, and it absolutely comes out of nowhere. And this little 7-year-old kid blows Omar away in the bodega. The bodega bathroom.
Knew it.
Anyway, so I'm watching the show, and all of a sudden when Omar gets killed, I go, oh my God. Like, I was beside myself. Like, this can't be happening. Did they just kill Omar? And it wasn't like the final episode of the season either. It was about 3/4 of the way through the season when they kill Omar. I mean, well, that was the thing about that show, is that all bets were off. You know, like, anybody could die, anybody could go at any time. And that was one of the reasons why there was such authenticity to it, is that it took risks, that show. So anyway, so I end up watching the rest of the episode. I go to bed. And the next evening, my ex-brother-in-law, her brother, shows up, and he and I were going to go out to the bar and hang out. And so Heather started watching the episode of The Wire, and I told my brother-in-law, and I'm like, hey, let's just watch a little bit of this with her. So we're watching it, and I just wanted to see her reaction when Omar got killed. That was the only reason. I wanted to see her genuine reaction to the first time seeing Omar get killed. So I'm sitting on the couch next to him, the scene's coming up, and I'm just kind of, so I just kind of turn and I start watching her, because I know, you know, what's coming. And when it happens, like, her eyes were so, like, opened up so wide, they were like saucers, and her mouth just, her jaw dropped. And she started to tear up. She's like, and then she looked at me and she goes, did they just kill off Omar? And I'm like, yeah, they did. She's like, why didn't you tell me? And I'm like, you would have killed me if I would have told you. Like, I'm going to say, hey, honey, make sure you watch the Wire today, because this is the episode where they kill off Omar. And I'm like, of course I wasn't going to tell you. And she's like, all right, I know that makes sense, but I just can't handle this. Like, it's like, so then Ryan and I left. Yeah. Her brother and I just went out.
To the bar.
But I did get to see the expression on her face when Omar got killed.
It's like a subgenre of YouTube videos, is like people watching shocking moments in television. I know, yeah. Game of Thrones has provided a couple of those, but really it goes back to The Wire.
One of my favorite of those, like, watching someone watch something videos, which have become really popular for some weird reason. My favorite one ever. And you should look this up. It's this young girl's reaction. She had just come back from being a missionary, and so she missed Rogue One. So, and she's like they set this all up. She is a massive Star Wars fan, like a ridiculous Star Wars fan. And so her boyfriend filmed her watching the last 5 minutes of Rogue One, and it is a delight. So she gets so excited, she starts crying. When Carrie Fisher shows up at the end, she loses it, like she's blowing her nose. And then finally, like, after like 5 minutes of her like crying and just like, oh my God, it's so good, it's so good, she looks over and she goes, are you filming this? But it's my favorite one. I've seen it a million times. It's just this young girl watching the end of Rogue One. Oh, it's so good. All right. Another character here that's been picked. Olivia Pope from Scandal. That's Kerry Washington's character was picked by somebody here. I love this one. Kenneth Parcell from 30 Rock. He was great. He was great. Jack McBrayer. He's so funny. So funny on that show. Someone chose SpongeBob SquarePants. From SpongeBob SquarePants is one of the greatest TV characters of all time. Of course, Walter White in Breaking Bad. Bryan Cranston's descent into drug lord Heisenberg on Breaking Bad cements his place on this list. Has there ever been a show which made viewers go from rooting to a character to hating him over the course of 5 seasons? That's what Cranston did, as he transformed from the show's protagonist to its main antagonist after a timid high school Walter White was diagnosed with terminal cancer and decided to start a meth empire with an old student.
I'll say I never stopped rooting for him on some level.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think that's what the strength of the character was, is that he got you to root for someone that was, despite committing like horrendous crimes, you understood why.
Yeah. Well, that was a really complex show.
Yeah.
It really was. And man, Cranston was amazing on that show. And so was Paul Aaron.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's just one of those shows. And coming from the mind of a guy, I think Vince Gilligan was writing on the X-Files for Mondo years, and it just came out of him. And I'm like, wow, that's incredible. And I'm sure there's a huge writing team behind it, but really those three guys made this show in the conversation for some of the best of all time.
All right, one more before we break here of characters. Philip J. Fry from Futurama.
Oh, yeah.
You got to love Fry. First of all, Futurama is a great show.
I like it better than The Simpsons, to be honest.
Well, I do too, because it's had more quality seasons than The Simpsons. The Simpsons had that stretch. Simpsons had that stretch, to be fair, from like 92 to 97 when there was nothing better on TV.
Untouchable.
Nothing. Nothing better. But it's very spotty since then.
Mm-hmm.
But Futurama, consistently funny. Mm-hmm. Consistently funny. And one of my favorite stories is that I know a girl who actually has a crush on Fry. Like, she has a crush on a cartoon character.
Celebrity crush.
She's like, I got a crush, and I don't care what anybody says, I got a crush on Fry. And I'm like, well, you know that's a cartoon character. She's like, no, he's real, in my opinion.
Ooh.
So, all right. Let's break here for some weather, and then we'll take a break, and then my dad will tell a joke. So today, wind chill advisory is in effect through the mid-morning. Temperatures from 5 below well inland to 2 above downtown. For tomorrow, cloudy, very cold. Highs struggle to reach 20 degrees. For Wednesday, sunshine. Highs reach the middle 20s. Thursday, cloudy. Chance of snow by the afternoon, especially south of the city. Temperatures creep toward 30. And then Friday, mostly sunny in the afternoon. Temperatures break freezing for the first time in nearly a week. All right, let's take a break. And then my dad tells a joke right after this.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go. With your music intro.
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah. What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah. That's right. That delightful theme that we hear every Monday morning indicates that my dad is calling in to tell a joke. And welcome back. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. And my dad, Nick, likes to tell jokes. So we have him tell jokes right here on the show every Monday morning. And let's welcome my dad to the show. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Good.
All right. How's Ma?
Doing good. Everybody's fine.
All right. Good. You got a joke?
I got a joke. I bought a dozen golf balls the other day. The clerk says, shall I wrap them up? I said, no, I'll drive them home.
All right.
I'll drive them home. I get it, Dad.
I get it.
All right, man. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
There you go. There's my dad telling a joke. I'll drive them home. All right, let's hit that thing.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
And he'll do it again next Monday morning right here on 720 WGN. By the way, they're doing this story. I don't know if you read this story or not. They're doing a story on right now on Channel 9 about how a guy and a dog who were stranded in a car survived on Taco Bell sauce. Did you hear about this?
Yeah, I didn't give them permission to use my likeness.
They were in a... They were in a car for, I think it was like 6 days or something.
Ah, oh, jeez.
And they survived on Taco Bell sauce.
Well, now, you know, my mom can't get mad at me when I survive off of nothing but
Taco Bell sauce. I'm telling you. All right.
Pet friendly.
Incredible. Okay, the Hawks played last night, and the results were not good. And they had a rough road trip in the first place, so... Yeah. So, but we always play the Blackhawks Express after the morning after every game. So let's do it. Here's the Express.
The
Chicago Blackhawks' playoff hopes took a serious hit yesterday in L.A., and now they have to win consistently in order to save their season. They'll face a stiff challenge tonight here in San Jose, where the Sharks can be absolutely merciless in their home ice, appropriately named as the Shark Tank. The Hawks' mandate is simple here tonight. Everybody comes to play, and no passengers. Iron with the puck behind the Hawk net. Gustafson there to reach around Pavelski. Put it over to Kane. And with a backhanded flip, he slings it through the air to center ice, forcing the Sharks to regroup. Hurdle back into the Hawk zone down the slot. Shoots and scores. Quick transition by the Sharks. Kane did get the clear, but the Sharks got the puck back. Meyer took it and raced into the Hawk zone as the Hawks were in the midst of a line change. One-on-one with Duncan Keith. And Hurdle fired it past Ward. It's 1-0 San Jose. Classic. He was knocked down, lost the puck. Patrick Kane left corner. Kane fed it to the line. Deep slot, Gustafson. Long wrist shot, deflects in front. Everybody poking at it. Kane's got it with the backhand. Jones is down with a butterfly save, and he'll hold on. 35 seconds for the period. Hurdle to LeBanc for the Hawk line. Made a pass, deflected away with a puck check by Seabrook. Couldn't break it. To Strome over the Shark line. Left circle. Shoots and scores! Dylan Strome off of a setup from Alex DeBrincat. Strome let it rip, and it hit the near post and ricochets in behind Martin Jones. And with 27 seconds left in the first period, we're tied at one here in San Jose. To Jonas Donskoy over the Hawk line down the left wing. Tries to fight through a check from Dahlstrom and cannot. Falls under Dahlstrom in the corner. Meyer will swat it down behind the net around to the right point. He fires. They score. Cutting in front of the Hawk net, I believe Timo Meyer tipped this. And it deflects past Cam Ward. The Sharks are back on top and 2-1. Haley carrying around to the left half boards. Turns around and whips the puck in front of the Hawk net. Slides all the way through the far boards. Carlson fires from there. Big save by Ward. Follow-up shot there is gobbled up by Cam Ward, and he holds on. Taves takes the puck behind the Shark net. Carries around, moves it. Gustafson right point down to Taves beside the right circle. Give the go to Gustafson on the slot. Chichi scores! Eric Gustafson off of a beautiful dish from Jonathan Taves. Rolled into the area at the tops of the circles and let it rip, and it beats Jones, and once again we're tied, this time at two. Ward got it back in behind the net, put it around to the right wing boards to Donskoy, to Joe Thornton, right wing corner. Here's Thornton trying to lead a pass through the legs of Anisimov, and Anisimov pulls his feet to put it to Sorensen in the slot, he shoots and scores. Well, Marcus Thornton off the Sharks bench, raced down to the scoring area and caught a perfect pass from Joe Thornton. And in the next motion, he fired it past Cam Ward. 4:27 into the third period, the Sharks retake the lead. Here the Sharks the other way. Haley draws a penalty to the Hawks. Haley into the Hawks zone, right wing, slings a backhander on goal, turned wide, stick save. Haley got it back to Burns, high slot, shoots it. It to Brent Burns, and the leading scoring defenseman in the NHL adds another point. He beats Ward. It's now 4-2 San Jose with 11:44 left in the third. Horsling tries to move it down to the corner, lost the puck. Goodrow scoops it ahead. And here's Malcolm Carlson at the hot line. And he scores. Empty net goal for San Jose's Malcolm Carlson. This will be his second of the game. With 2:22 left in the third, it's now 5-3 San Jose. Side behind the net with 12. To Kane right corner. To Gustafson straight away with a drive. Hit Carlson, skate ricochets to the right corner. Kane's got it with 5. Here's Kane dropping it to Gustafson right point. To Kane, high slot. Winds and fires, blocked in front. Kane's got the puck. Got away one last shot. It's not going to matter. Time ticks off the clock, and the San Jose Sharks win the hockey game 5-2.
Frustrating. Very, very frustrating. They actually played really good hockey for the first two periods, especially the second period. They played great hockey. That was a really exciting game to watch, and then it all fell apart in the third. Next game is Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. And it's at home. I believe they return home and they play on Thursday. We'll find out the details. So that's coming up. And we'll have a Blackhawks Express the day after, as we always do, the morning after. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. A few more great TV characters, memorable characters. Tom, do you watch Atlanta?
Yeah. Very, very into Atlanta. Love Brian Tyree.
Yep.
Henry as Paperboy.
Paperboy. One of the greatest characters of all time. I think Atlanta is easily one of the best shows on TV. And I think Donald Glover's a genius. Why am I blanking on the last name? Teddy. The episode where Teddy. The character he's under, it's Donald Glover underneath all the makeup, and he's like that weird dude, and it's just Lakeith Stanfield and him, and it's just that it's just those two characters.
Yeah,
Teddy, I can't remember the last name. That was one of the greatest episodes of television I've ever seen. And speaking of Paperboy, one of the funniest episodes of Atlanta, like unbelievably funny, because that show is all over the map. It's serious, it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the best shows on TV without question. But the episode where Paperboy is just trying to get a haircut. Oh my God. And the guy who plays the barber.
Yeah.
Unbelievably funny. I mean, that whole episode was ridiculously funny. Like, I was laughing out loud. And the thing about it is that the slow burn that Paperboy does throughout that entire episode where he's just like, come on, man. And then he's like frustrated the whole time. And he can't leave because they started the haircut, and it's like part of his hair has been shaved.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta is a great show.
I love the one where they have, it's like a fake TV network.
And interviewing. Yeah.
The commercials alone are worth the price of admission.
Well, I got to say, at first they fooled me.
Oh,
At first they fooled me. I was like, what the hell is this? You know, when they would bust to a commercial, I'd be like, what is this? And then I was like, okay, so this is, these are fake commercials.
Was it the Mickey's commercial where they're pouring it into champagne glasses?
I can't remember, but I just remember like the first commercial, I was like, what the hell is this? And then I was like, oh, I see. But the thing that gave it away though, for people who maybe were trying to fool, was that during the fake commercials, the FX logo was still in the bottom right-hand corner.
There it was, yeah.
So that, because, you know, it's still their TV show, so. Mm-hmm. All right, so those are some memorable characters. Thanks, everybody, for participating in that. And we shall be back tomorrow at 1 a.m. And, Tom, thanks, man. I appreciate it. It was fun working with you.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.